Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show coming to you live from the, well, the capital of Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Also, Sinkhole Central. Yes, I just saw this great interactive map of the city of Harrisburg. 41 sinkholes. There's one right outside the door of our studio. Sinkhole Central. What's it going to take? What's it going to take? Governor's cavalcade is going to take, his motorcade to get swallowed up by one of these sinkholes. I mean, you know, you look at what's going on, it just boggles the mind. Last week's State of the State address, it addressed a number of very disturbing things, some very disturbing realizations on our state, on the state of our state. One big one being the state of disrepair and structural deficiencies of our roads and our bridges. And, well, I got to be honest, the need for a greater vision with regard to our needs and our public transit. Going to talk about that. State of the Union coming up. State of the Union address coming up tomorrow. What will not be addressed? Will the dreaded U word be uttered? Will there be any talk of workers, or will it just be about jobs? It'll be a jobs talk. Because I like how the Democrats, they talk about jobs. Well, we're going to great job. Without talking about the workers who those jobs are for. What kind of conditions are they going to be? What kind of wages? What kind of benefits? What's it going to mean for our society? What's it going to mean for our communities? Are there going to be jobs where we're going to barely survive and have to ask for health care? Is it going to be part-time jobs? We're going to see a bunch of this nonsense coming up in the next several months. What's it going to be? Also, the election focused on many issues. Poverty, in my mind, was not one of them. Sure, Mitt focused his attacks on the working poor with his very articulate attack on the 47% of workers who do not earn enough money to pay federal taxes. But is anyone really working on poverty, and will that be part of the State of the Union address tomorrow night? We'll talk about that. Also, as we see education funding being stolen away and the school districts being focused to cut programs and limit courses, shouldn't we be looking at all the wasted money on these standardized tests? All of this money going to these big corporations who now have proprietary command of 2+2. Should we be thinking about this? Well, there's a movement sweeping across the country. That's calling on parents, calling on students, teachers, to examine the standardized testing and possibly opt out if they're not worth the resource. Also going to talk about more on the no rights at work agenda being pushed forth by the radical right. Our governor has, it appears, turned his back on several hundred thousand workers here in the Commonwealth and their families by denying them access to the Medicaid expansion. We're going to talk about that. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Interesting weekend. We're going to talk bobblehead Sunday a little bit later. But the Pope, retiring. I didn't know popes could retire. I didn't know you could just go, you know what, I've done enough. I've done enough prayer. I've done enough, forgiving and enough with the holy water. And maybe the Pope Mobile was breaking down too much. I don't know. Maybe it was claustrophobic. Who knows? But the Pope is retiring. First time in 600 years that the pontiff has decided, yeah, I'm going to step down. Golf, maybe. Maybe Bikini Beach. Yeah, whatever. So it'll be interesting to see how this rolls out in the coming days, weeks, and months. Personally, not a big concern. I guess we'll just now be in the white puff of smoke alert for the next couple of months. Interesting to find out how that goes. Love to hear your thoughts on it. Also, the paternal family response to the Sandusky. I look at this and I go, if you're going to have a PR campaign, if you're going to, roll out a PR campaign, I think it should be a little bit better than he didn't know anything. Which, from all the stories that I've read, he knew nothing. And I've had this conversation a number of times with folks that if he didn't know, that to me would be a measure of incompetence. I mean, if you're going to be the ruler of the universe there, you get to that place by knowing everything that goes around. You know the people that are around you. And I find it extraordinarily hard to believe that there were no rumors, that there was nothing. And I guess, part of it is my own bias, because I went to a high school where, the guru of the athletic department, there was a kid toucher. But everybody knew it, and everybody knew it for years. I mean, that's one of those things that does not go without being said. Just in really hushed tones. Because everybody knew. I mean, I go back to my school. Everybody knew. In fact, you know, when my mother went there, you know, 20 years earlier, she knew. In fact, even before it was a possibility of me ever going to that school, he was the example of people you stay away from. And even to this day, you know, I'm still leery, and I don't think, and the whole Sandusky thing, I guess I just have a little different perspective on. I blame parents. At the end of the day, parents are the ones who said, yeah, go ahead, go play, go over with the... No. Never in a million years. It was the same thing with Michael Jackson. Sorry, you cannot have my teenager or my 8 or 10 year old child sleep over at your house. Sorry, I don't care how rich and famous, powerful, no. And even to this day, you know, if there's someone with one of my kids' sports who doesn't have a kid on the team and is still coaching the team, I'm a little uncomfortable with that. Maybe that's just me. But, you know, the response was predictable. The response pulled in someone with some juice here in the Commonwealth. Still didn't buy it. It'll be interesting to see where the trial goes. It'll be interesting to see what comes out of the depositions. I'm still of the mindset that he had to know. And if he didn't, he should have been fired anyway. That simple with me. Maybe you've got a different thought. We'd love to hear that as well. Tonight the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO had their legislative reception, had a bunch of legislators over, you know, to do the handshaking. So I happened over to, I hate going to these things because, you know, I hate big crowds. But I had a really interesting conversation with a guy who's a new legislator. And I like new legislators because they still have it that, hey, we can change things. And hey, there are some things that are wrong. It doesn't matter party, it doesn't matter ideology, it's either right or it's wrong. And he was talking about that he was sitting in a committee here, he's on the finance committee, and he was talking about, we just gave away like $26 million more dollars in tax cuts. You know, they just passed a bill for more tax cuts for business. And he was talking about the governor's little speech the other day where he had the little girl stand up who had autism and said, you know, we're gonna end the long lines for people with disabilities like that. And he goes, yeah, he posed the question. He goes, what kind of response do you think I would have gotten from those people in the room had I proposed $26 million to go towards autism research or to go to helping those kids? The first thing they would say, well, where are you going to get the money to pay for that? But he said he sat in this room and nobody asked the question, we're giving $26 million away to these big businesses. Where are we going to get it? What's it going to come from? Is it going to come from education? Is it going to come from those programs for kids with autism? Is it going to come from programs for seniors? Where is it going to come? Where's the money for all of these tax cuts going to come from? And I said, well, I would imagine, you know, the response you would get, being, you know, jaded and having followed this stuff for a while would be, you know, on both sides of the political spectrum. Well, you know, those tax cuts are going to create jobs. And those tax cuts are going to create jobs and people are going to pay revenue back and it's going to pay for itself. It's like free money. It's like when my wife tells me, well, you know, I bought this thing, but it was on sale. And since it was on sale, we were going to buy it at some point down the road anyway. So it being on sale, I actually saved you money. That's actually a positive. I mean, it's very, very bizarre thinking. And my wife doesn't try that because it doesn't work. But evidently in the political world, it does. This idea that somehow we're going to give money to these employers and they're going to create jobs with it. Well, the reality is they don't. And we've seen that played out for the last 30 years. And there have been study after study after study that says tax breaks don't create jobs. We know that to already be true, yet the talking heads and the politicians have stuck to it. Because they say, well, you know, it's a good talking point, and it makes sense. You know, if we give these employers money, they'll have this basket of money, and they will then create jobs. It will be like magic fairy dust. When the reality is, the only thing that creates jobs is demand. Let's say we give transportation companies, you know, construction companies, huge tax breaks, but we don't invest in roads and bridges. Are they going to hire people? No. They're going to probably go on vacation because they don't have any work to do. I say take that money, put it into roads and bridges, put those people back to work, don't give them a tax break, and guess what? They've got a job. And they're going to create jobs because, hey, you know what? There's demand. They're going to feed that demand. Simple stuff. Oh, and by the way, they pay taxes. So I guess you could make the argument that by investing in roads and bridges, if I have to use that line of thinking, that theory that they love to throw out, that, you know, hey, like my wife would say, it's on sale. I saved you money. If we're going to use that line of thinking, taking money, spending it on roads and bridges and infrastructure and the pipes underneath the streets here in Harrisburg that are 120 years old, by doing that, here's the math. And I actually like this because I actually think this math actually works. By investing in that, we don't have large sinkholes. We don't have failures of infrastructure. And guess what? Those people who are redoing the stuff, they have jobs. And they pay taxes. And it creates this snowball effect where things start growing. And you ever see the cartoon where the snowball starts at the top of the hill really small and it keeps rolling, keeps rolling, keeps rolling until it's enormous? That's basically how the economy works. You get a little economic activity going, it starts rolling downhill. And everything starts going and growing and growing and growing and growing. That's what we need. We don't need more handouts. Don't need it at all. And this idea that, and we've heard it from the right for a couple of years now. Oh, well, the reason that the job creators aren't creating jobs is, well, they're uncertain. They're just reluctant. Because, well, their taxes might go up, or, oh, there might be regulation. Well, a new study out by the San Francisco Federal Reserve, and this is their right from their study. There was almost no correlation between job growth in a state from 2008 to 2011 and increase in the percentage of business citing regulation and taxes as their primary concern. In fact, if anything, the correlation was positive. So this idea that, well, the lowest taxes and the lowest regulations, somehow that was better, this is saying, no, not so much. In fact, just kind of the opposite. But here again, we've been fed this time and time again, just like we're being fed austerity's the way to go. You know, we need to cut those welfare people. We need to cut food stamps. We need to cut unemployment because it'll make them tougher and they'll pull themselves up by their bootstraps and we'll save money. Well, that hasn't worked. And we don't need theory to figure this out. We have a working model going on right in front of us. You look across the pond to the UK. Who is on the brink of a triple dip recession. Why? Well, austerity. They figured out, oh gee, you know, we take money out of the economy. Guess what? We've taken money out of the economy, so it shrinks. And guess what? They lay people off. And guess what? Those people who get laid off, they don't spend any money. And guess what? Other people get laid off. But we're not going to hear the Republicans really talk about that. And according to the latest study from the folks at the Institute for Fiscal Studies, they've come out and said, well, the UK is going to be borrowing somewhere around $65 billion more next year than they would have otherwise. Thanks to what? Oh, yeah. The A word. Austerity. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show. You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
A restaurant receipt on which a customer complained of being charged an automatic gratuity was posted online and went viral the first week of February when the worker who posted it got fired. It jump-started a discussion about low-paid restaurant workers, their lack of job security, and the role of tipping. Wynn's Melinda Tuhus has the story.
Chelsea Welch was working at an Applebee's restaurant in St. Louis, Missouri, when another server showed her the receipt, on which was scribbled, "I give 10% to God, why do you get 18?" and wrote "Pastor" next to it. Welch posted it on Reddit, trying to be careful not to reveal any personal information or even that it was an Applebee's receipt. When the pastor learned it had been posted, she demanded that everyone involved be fired.
My manager, who I adore, looks at me and says, "You're probably going to lose your job over this, and I'm sorry." Apparently, they get a hold of upper management, and they say, "Let her go. Let her go right now."
Welch says she was heartened by a friend and fellow employee who gave his 2 weeks' notice to quit in solidarity when she was fired, and by the global outpouring of support, including job offers from near and far. She also loved that one man went into an Applebee's, ordered a glass of water, and left a $10 tip with a nasty note to management referencing her firing. She thinks that would be more effective than a boycott, which has been proposed all over the web.
I've really not spoken out in favor of any boycotts of Applebee's because it punishes the people who have the job that I had. But something that sends the message to Applebee's that they probably took things a little too far, you know, they're far more disciplinary actions than just termination.
Tips supplement what's often a meager hourly wage. That federal minimum has not budged in 22 years. Chelsea Welch says all states should institute minimum wage for restaurant employees, and even that is far from a living wage. Melinda Tuhus, Workers Independent News.
This story was underwritten by a grant from the Burger Marx Foundation. Workers at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center who had been fired for their efforts to organize will be reinstated. SEIU Healthcare Pennsylvania is working with maintenance workers at the UPMC facilities who wish to have union representation. The union filed charges with the National Labor Relations Board against UPMC last year, alleging that nurses were inappropriately fired and that the medical organization had been using intimidation tactics against employees. According to the NLRB's Pittsburgh office, a settlement had been reached with UPMC, and they agreed to stop intimidating employees. Details of the settlement were not made publicly available, and both sides declined to comment on the full details. This newscast made possible in part through underwriting support from the IBEW. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
Claustrophobia, hypochondria, xenophobia, rolled up into one.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So Rob Gleason, the chairman of the Pennsylvania Republican Party, who had made some introductory remarks about Corbett on Friday night at the Lincoln dinner, said that Corbett was the most pro-growth and pro-jobs governor this Commonwealth has ever seen. And you go, you really? What about those 20,000 teachers and support professionals that the governor's $2 billion over the last 2 years has gutted out? What about all those state workers that have been kicked to the curb and all the jobs that went along with that? And what about the fact that for 2 years now he's done absolutely nothing on infrastructure? Had a nice little transportation advisory commission come up with a really nice, high-colored, glossy report. $200,000 of taxpayer dollars sat on the shelf, nothing. And everything that he's done on public transit has been negative. I look at what's going on in Allegheny County, and it, to me, criminal, which is why today folks from around the Commonwealth, workers, riders, politicians, citizens, folks came out and said, you know what? We're going to tell this governor what we want. And Molly Nichols was one of those folks here. She's a volunteer activist for Pittsburghers for Public Transportation. She was the MC at today's event. Molly, thanks for taking time for me.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me.
You know, I look at this and hey, you did a great job today, by the way.
Thank you so much.
But I look at this and I go, you know, this is what we need to be doing more of, bringing workers together, bringing the riders together, bringing community leaders together and say, you know what, this is how people move around. This is how folks need to get to work and get their kids to school and do all of those things that, well, folks in cities absolutely need to do.
Exactly. You hit the nail right on the head. We think that transit is a human right, that especially in urban regions, people need to be able to get to school, work, grocery store, doctor's office, churches, shops, all of that. And without a bus, some people I meet on the buses, since the buses were cut in Pittsburgh and the fares have gone up, they either have to move or quit their job or choose not to go to school because they can't afford the bus or the bus no longer comes to their neighborhood.
So
we're saying.
You throw that into the context of GOP Chairman Rob Gleason's statement that this governor is the most pro-growth and pro-jobs governor ever, and it doesn't seem to jive with me.
Yeah, it doesn't. We worry that Governor Corbett listens much too much to corporations and not the people of Pennsylvania. And he may support growth for corporations, but that often doesn't have enough of a positive impact on the people in our state. And so he has this plan that he's just come out with, a transportation plan, but we do commend efforts to get transportation funding, of course. But the problem with this one is it doesn't secure enough funding to meet the needs of the state.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, is that what he did last week during the State of the State? Did he put some money on the table for transportation funding? Because what I saw him say is $1.8 billion over the next 5 years. And if you look at his own commission, his hand-picked commission, they said in that time frame we need about $6 to $6.5 billion. So did he really make any attempt? I mean, 1.8 to me is not really even an attempt.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly not enough. And the other problem is that it's only for 5 years. We need something that would go much further down the road. And one example for transit this next year is all that is given is $40 million. SEPTA's needs right now in Philadelphia are $38 million. So that tells you, like, how much of a disconnect there is, especially because we don't only want to restore the service that's been cut and lower the fares that have been risen, but we want to expand service. Right now in Pittsburgh, buses go by completely full. People have to sit and wait in the freezing cold for the next bus to come. Some entire communities have lost service altogether. And, you know, he will say there's debates all about this lifting the cap on the gas tax, which will probably affect consumers. But for our position, we think that this funding doesn't have to come at the expense of workers or riders or residents of Pennsylvania. Instead, these corporate tax breaks that Corbett keeps giving and allowing these corporate tax loopholes to continue. If one loophole was closed, we would bring in $800 million in the state in 1 year.
If you just close that, you close that magic box in Delaware, that tax haven across the border in Delaware, and we've got plenty of money. And by the way, maybe if we stop giving so much money to these big corporations and the very well-to-do special interests, the $2.4 billion last year that he gave away, maybe we'd have money for education and health care and, oh, by the way, public transportation.
Exactly. We also have concerns, and the Corbett administration and different people we've been in touch with, it's really, we get mixed signals on this, but we've heard of efforts to privatize both transit and transportation where certain lines would be, you know, given to private companies, some of these contracts that happen behind closed doors that the public doesn't get a say over. And we know from our region's history that privatization is an utter disaster for transit. The, you know, quality of service goes way down, the safety, the wages for workers, and fares go up, you know, and then private companies, they provide service only when and where it is profitable to do so. So then all these communities get left out. And, you know, today one Republican representative, John Taylor, said that he didn't think privatization was on the table, but we've heard from others that it could be, and the plan talks about these private-public partnerships, which could be a euphemism for what that really means. So
could
we're
be.
Also
could
there
be.
To make sure it stays public.
Could be. No, the P3s are that's not a euphemism. That is privatization. in my book. That is, it's exactly, and I, because I got that exact same quote from him, because I'm going to remember that and hold him to it, because I've been hearing privatization is on the table, and you look at the governor's own transportation plan that sits on my desk, it's right there front and center. So for him to say that to me, either he's not in on the right meetings, they're holding him aside, because look, he's from the Philadelphia area. To me, this is our governor pitting the center part of the state against the ends, against Pittsburgh, against Philadelphia. That's all this really is, in my book.
Yeah, we'll see how that plays out. The good news is I think enough people, Terzai, a representative from Pittsburgh, the Senate Majority Leader, he wanted to separate transit and transportation so that the funding streams were separate, which would be a complete disaster. And basically, there's this whole myth that rural counties pay for public transit, and you know, and they don't think that they should have to because they're not using it. But in reality, the way the tax base works, the amount of money that comes from cities toward the roads that are all around the state is, you know, without that city's tax base, none of those roads could exist. So it's really important for them to be interconnected. And the good news today is that, you know, our group, Pittsburgh's for Public Transit, we have I don't know what the word is about our relationship to legislators. Sometimes we see them come out and support us. Other times we wonder why there aren't efforts like to close this loophole. But today, a big number of legislators came out in support of what we're saying. And Dan Frankel has bills he's putting forward for transportation and says that, that there's a big number of Democrats that will not sign on to Corbett's bill if it doesn't meet certain needs. And something like privatization, they said, is a complete nonsense.
Right.
So that's good news. I mean, and that's when we really need constituents and the residents of Pennsylvania listening right now to call their legislators and say they want dedicated long-term funding for public transit and that it remains public and that we can get that without it coming at the expense of workers and riders. We really want to make sure, too, that the workers' wages stay strong and stay. A lot of them are having to work overtime, and a recent article came out about workers being too fatigued because right now their schedules are so tight and they have to drive so quickly to get to, you know, to meet the schedule of the bus because they don't want to have to hire more workers. So we're all really trying to make sure that workers' rights stay central, and it's really a matter of public safety. I mean, if you don't have good conditions for transit workers, that's not good conditions for riders.
I'm right there with you. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Molly Nichols, volunteer activist for Pittsburghers for Public Transit. You guys have a website?
We do. It's www.pittsburghforpublictransit.org. And you can go there and see we have a transit bill of rights that kind of lays out what we think transit should look like. And you can become a supporter by emailing us. And if you're in Pittsburgh, we have meetings the third Saturday of every month. But part of today was launching this more statewide coalition of groups from all around the state. So there'll be more things coming up, so continue to check our website. We'll probably head back to Harrisburg sometime soon and continue to really ramp up the pressure to get dedicated funding for our
transit. That's exactly the reason I asked, because, you know, this is a statewide thing. I live in Carlisle, which I had heard during your presentation that you originated from or lived there at some point. And when I first moved to the Carlisle area, there was some talk about Corridor 1, which was a light rail project that they had thought might fly from Carlisle to Harrisburg. And I said, you know,
I didn't know about that. I'm from Carlisle. I lived there since I was 7 years old. It's my hometown. I love it. And I never used public transit there. Then I went to school in New York City and obviously used it. And then Pittsburgh recognized how valuable it is. But that would be so amazing to have that.
Yeah, and this is why I think it's so important to hear what folks in Pittsburgh and what folks in other places, in New York and Washington. I go to D.C. all the time, and, you know, we use the public transportation there all the time, and wish the option were here. And I hear a lot from Republicans about, you know, choice, consumer choice, hearing a lot about hocking off the liquor stores. You know, consumers have choice. Well, I don't have a choice. I have to drive my car into Harrisburg. There is no choice. I want that choice.
Yeah, you know, they're also talking about getting rid of the Amtrak service from Harrisburg to Pittsburgh.
Yeah, 225,000 people a year make that trip, but they're gonna kick those 225,000 people back onto the roads. And,
yeah,
you know,
and
The argument.
If you think about the environment, I mean, I said today at the rally, the first green jobs were transit jobs. Like, this is what we need. We need to take a step in this direction where people are not driving. It's such a part of our culture, but if we have strong transit with great buses that are fuel efficient and good for the environment, and you can get 60 people on one bus. I mean, and if it's a you know, smooth experience for people, they'll start to wean themselves off their cars and get on the bus or the train, and that's kind of our vision.
Absolutely. And the other part of it is, look, even if you don't want to take public transportation, say you're someone, I'm just not going to do it. You know the 60 people who went on that bus? They're not the 60 cars in front of you sitting in traffic for 5.5 million hours last year, wasting 3 billion gallons of gasoline in this country.
Precisely. That's huge. It's not just the riders who are affected. The entire community are off when more people are taking public transit.
So what is the Bill of Rights? Walk me through what it is we're looking for.
Okay. So in the Bill of Rights, well, we have the initial, like, members of our community need public mass transit for basic mobility, for access to all the things I've listed before, and that it's a vital part of any healthy metropolitan area, and we see it as essential infrastructure, like roads, bridges, tunnel, airports, utilities, right? Cutting off a transit line could be equivalent to cutting off someone's water or heat or the road to their house.
Cutting off the opportunity. Look, I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland, and we weren't on the bus line. So there was no opportunity in that because there was no way to get to the jobs.
Right. Exactly. How are people supposed to get jobs, go to school when they have no way to get there and they can't afford to move to the neighborhood where they can get to the school and the job?
Yep.
Yeah. So we say that it's a right to public mass transit that includes safe, reliable, environmentally sustainable, and affordable transit that is accessible to all. And then two, living wages, benefits, safe working conditions, and union rights for transit workers. Three is dedicated and sustainable funding for public transit. Four is equitable distribution of transit costs with corporations paying their fair share. And five is transit that meets the needs of each community with no communities left out. So that's our Bill of Rights.
And it's something that we should be taking across the state so that everybody has that option. You know, and for me, it just seems like common sense. And since, you know, and maybe we could make GOP Chairman Rob Gleason, maybe we can make him right when he seems to believe that Corbett is the most pro-growth, pro-jobs governor in the Commonwealth's history. Because we're talking, if we do what you're talking about, a lot of jobs.
Yeah, exactly. And really ironic, last year when Corbett was even in the midst of giving a tax break of $1.7 billion to Shell to make a cracker plant in Allegheny County. I don't know if you heard about that.
Oh, absolutely.
And he insisted it was going to bring thousands of jobs. Okay. The long-term jobs is 400, while simultaneously last year, guess how many bus drivers were about to lose their jobs?
400.
Exactly. So
but here's the thing.
Give $1.7 billion to this environmentally damaging cracker plant to have eventually 400 jobs while he axes 400 bus drivers.
And I've got the perfect answer for that. In fact, we talked to one of the 600 workers at that Horsehead plant that they're going to be putting the cracker plant into, who's losing his job. He said that the governor's not interested in retaining jobs. He's only interested in creating new ones that he can use for PR campaigns. So if you've got a job in this Commonwealth right now, he doesn't care if you lose it. It's only that if he has a moment, say, look, I got a ribbon cutting ceremony, got big scissors out. That's what he cares about.
Wow. You know what else I heard today? Someone said at the Capitol, his approval rating is 27%.
Yep, and only 41% among Republicans. This is going to be one-term Tom, and he knows it. So he's going all out to get everything that the people who are pulling his strings want, and they know it as well. It's simple stuff. Last question I've got for you. You know, you look at this whole transit debate, and one of the things that the reason Corridor 1 did not happen in the Carlisle areas because, well, the politicians are visionless and they think only about the next election. And they say, well, we just can't afford it. It won't operate at a profit. And I guess the question I have, or the line of thought that I have, is should public transportation be something that is only pursued or done if we can turn a profit at it? Or do you think it's something that's for the common good and good for society?
Yeah. The latter, absolutely not. Is it something that can only happen if you can turn a profit? If that's how we want, if that's the world we want to live in, I really mourn that world. You know, we see it as, and this is where I get so upset about healthcare, because the health insurance companies decided they can make a profit off of people's suffering. And that's a whole other story. But with this, yeah, it's not about the profit making. And the thing is, the money is there. I mean, these, you know, you look at the whole language of the 1% and the richest people making more and more money each year. Pennsylvania has the most regressive, one of the most regressive tax structures in the whole country. You might know these numbers better about how little income tax the top 1% pay compared to the rest.
4.4%.
What is it?
4.4% the top 1% pays, as opposed to the person in the bottom 20% who pays 12% of their income.
Thank you.
That is completely outrageous.
Exactly. So if we see public transit as a service that everyone can have and that is good for the economy, and then we say, oh, well, this line doesn't run enough profit, it's not going to happen, you know, it doesn't make sense to me. If there's plenty of resources there, and if anything, it can help people grow and do, you know, this growth everyone talks about can happen with public transit. And it's also amazing to think about the communities that get formed on buses. We're doing a whole project. We got a grant in Pittsburgh to do transit tales, where we're hearing stories from people about their experiences on the bus. And then we're going to act some out on buses and make it a whole art theater kind of project. But it's amazing to kind of, I think about my experience when I get in my car and drive somewhere compared to when I'm on the bus and interacting with other human beings. You know, you're more clued into your community, which I
Which is the reason it must be destroyed.
Sorry?
Which is the reason it must be destroyed.
Oh, because they just want to isolate everyone.
I mean, think about it. You go back, you look at the welfare offices that you no longer have anymore. You look at unemployment offices that no longer exist. You look at anywhere where poor people congregate, where you can organize them. Do you see them anymore? No.
Right.
They don't.
Conquer.
Exactly. They don't want people coming together. They don't want collective action. They're very happy. Divide, conquer. They're very happy with, as Jay Gould said, I can easily pay half the working class to kill the other half. Very happy with that. And it's working for them, which is why I see what you're doing there in Pittsburgh is so vital to what we need to be doing, not just in Pittsburgh or here in our area, but across this country, bringing people back together, organizing and saying, you know what, we want certain things and we demand them, which is why I thought it was great that you were here in the Capitol today.
Great. Yeah, thank you so much. And there's actually a nonprofit called Americans for Transit that's working to do exactly what you just said, help groups across states and the country get together to make days like the one we just had happen and continue to make this. It means a national crisis.
Yep.
And so if the more and more groups that can come together and it get on the, you know, become the consciousness of so many people, that's going to make a huge difference. And, you know, the greatest moments in history have happened when thousands and millions of people have come together to make a change. So
exactly. I'm right there with you. As you get those stories, I would love to hear some of them, and I'd love if you'd send them our way, because I'm sure our audience would love to hear them as well.
Great. Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk, and it was a great conversation.
Anytime. Thanks so much. Molly Nichols, volunteer activist for Pittsburghers for Public Transit. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We got a day.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get The Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. TSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit tsecu.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let TSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the TSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. TSECU, financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit tsecu.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Since being thumped hard by voters last November, Republican leaders have gone through a period of reflection, introspection, and contemplation, and they now say they must make fundamental internal changes to become realistic political contenders. Does this mean they're finally going to quit being a political front for the Koch brothers' plutocratic fantasies, jettison their Tea Party nuttiness about everything from nullification to legitimate rape, or stop their destructive fixation on budget slashing? No, no, it's not their own deeply flawed fundamentals they intend to change, but the inner workings of America's election mechanics. The problem, they say, is not their unpopular policies or their offensive strategy of attacking whole swaths of the electorate, but that states are not allocating their electoral votes in ways that would throw the election to Republicans. For some time, we've seen GOP governors and election officials openly rigging rules and voting procedures to shut out students, minorities, seniors, and other likely Democratic voters from casting ballots. But now, top Republicans are going all out to fix vote allocation rules in selected swing states, enabling their presidential candidates to, quote, win even though they lose. For example, last fall, Obama won Florida, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Wisconsin. But with Republicans in control of those state governments, the GOP is scheming to award the electoral votes of those states in the future not to the statewide winner, but to the winner in each congressional district. If it had been fully implemented for last year's election, this arbitrary slicing and dicing would have diverted enough electoral votes to Romney to hand him the presidency. This is Jim Hightower saying, for more on the GOP's plot to steal the White House, see a full report at AmericanProgressAction.org. That's AmericanProgressAction.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
If this was done under Rendell's administration, the GOP would be jumping up and down like Rumpelstiltskin. I just want to make that point. I mean, the Republicans would be going nuts.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Also, if you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. So Friday night, Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell was in the area for the Lincoln dinner, saying very nice things about our pro-growth, pro-jobs governor. And, I saw this story and I thought, well, maybe our governors, maybe McDonald and Corbett had a conversation. Maybe we're going to see this. Evidently, McDonald there in Virginia said, well, Obamacare is coming, so our state employees who are part-time, no more than 29 hours. And evidently, it's on the way to being part of the law because it's been inserted into the state budget. And it looks like quite possibly the 37,000 employees there, of which more than 7,000 have worked, these part-time employees who work on average more than 30 hours, looks like they're going to be the ones who get screwed in all of this. And again, it's all about denying people just the basic right to health care. Just blows my mind. And our governor last week in the State of the State address, and I'm not sure, did he say he was going to take it? Did he say he was not? What was that? I think he's not going to, but here to help clear that up and talk about what the Medicaid expansion would have been is Mark Steer, former executive director of Penn Action. Mark, thanks for taking time for me.
My pleasure, Rick. Always happy to be here.
So the state of the state address, the thundering silence that it was, did you get the sense? I mean, I guess he's not going to take the expansion money.
It's not ultimately up to him, because if the General Assembly puts it in the budget and he signs the budget, we'll take it. But he clearly said he's not going to ask for it. And, you know, I don't think there might be a hint that he would veto a budget that includes it. I actually don't think he would actually veto it for political reasons, but he's not going to lift a finger to help us get it.
Right. But, you know, the thing is I look at this and I go, you know, what is it about this guy? First day in office, first couple of weeks in office, 41,000 low-wage workers booted off of adult basic last year, 89,000 kids off of the Medicaid. What is it about this guy and taking health care from people or wanting to keep them from it?
It's just very hard to understand. I mean, basically, he's part of this whole right-wing philosophy, which says we don't want to spend any of our tax money. And by our, they mean people, you know, the 50% who they think work, as opposed to 53 work as opposed to 47 who don't. We don't want to take any of our tax money to help people who need something. And, you know, we all know that that's nonsense. We all know that all of us benefit from the government in various ways. And ultimately, I think it's about not helping working people, not helping poor people, because you want to drive them to take the jobs at the lowest possible wages. You want to drive them into desperation. That's what it's all about.
Yeah, which is why I've been saying the creation of a desperation class, and you hit it right there. And I look at this, you know, who in their right mind would say, no, I'm not going to extend the opportunity to get some health security to, well, so I've seen numbers upwards of 700,000 adults in the Commonwealth. I don't understand the motive behind it. I don't understand why. I don't understand how.
You know, it's actually a great thing for Pennsylvania in a lot of ways. It will reduce the number of uninsured in the state by 52%. It will roughly 700,000 to 720,000 people will get health insurance through Medicaid. Medicaid's going to be improved because payments for doctors and hospitals are going to be a little better, and that means people will have access to health care when they might not have had it before. And the cost to the state is almost nothing. We're going to draw down $43 billion from the federal government over 10 years. For the first 3 years, it's 100% paid for by the federal government. Then it declines a little bit. But over that 10-year period, Pennsylvania will pay $4 billion. Now, in return for paying $4 billion, we're going to save almost $4 billion by saving money that the state already spends now for health care. So the net cost to the Commonwealth is almost nothing. And on top of it, we in Pennsylvania are already paying the taxes for the Medicaid expansion. The rich who are taxed under the Affordable Care Act are paying to provide money for states for Medicaid expansion. So the only question is, are we going to get the money in Pennsylvania, or is it all going to go to New York? And it looks like even Ohio is going to take it under Republican governors. Is it going to go to Connecticut? Is it going to go to the other states around us? And we won't get our fair share.
Yeah, because Kasich said he was going to take it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's crazy, because leave aside health care, leave aside everything else. Bringing $40 billion into the state over 10 years, even if you subtract out some of the money we save, it's going to create tens of thousands of jobs. And these are really good jobs. I mean, they're jobs for people with all levels of skill, all of education, from doctors to nurses to technicians to orderlies to janitors, all throughout the healthcare system. And those people will have jobs, and they'll spend money, which will create jobs outside the healthcare system. So maybe that's really what it's about. They don't want to do anything to create jobs because they like high unemployment. Because when you have high unemployment, people, again, are desperate.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of economy they want.
Yeah, and I look at this, and part of me goes, you know, this is, you know, if this works, it's going to fly in the face of 30 years of Republican ideology that government can do nothing and that government should do nothing. And that, look, when we control government, we destroy it. So see, look, it doesn't work. To me, that's one of the main drivers behind it.
Yeah. I mean, they don't want to admit that government ever can accomplish anything. When we know that the poverty rate for seniors is drastically lower than it otherwise would have been because of Social Security. We know that people get through Medicare, get really good health care. They live longer. They live more comfortably because of government programs. We know that Medicaid saves lives. And we know that this program will save lives, too. We've got to remember that two people that die a day are still dying in Pennsylvania for lack of health insurance. Medicaid expansion will take care of half the problem. How can you, in good conscience, turn down this basically free program and which benefits so many people, which saves lives, which saves people from the pain and suffering of untreated illness? I mean, it really is unconscionable, and there's something wrong with the moral compass of the Republican Party that's just there against this.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. But what do you say to those who would argue that, you know, if we allow this to happen, that you're going to let these folks who need this insurance, this security, that they're going to be somehow become dependent, and then they're going to find out, oh, hey, you know, because evidently there are a bunch of people who are eligible for food stamps and LIHEAP and other programs. There's a fear that once people start going, well, hey, you know, this actually benefits me, that they're going to start looking to other programs, and that's where the cost is.
Well, you know,
because I've heard them all.
If people deserve programs, if they're poor and they need help, they should get it. That's my bottom line. If people need help to have decent lives, we in this richest country in the world have responsibility to help them. The other fact is most people would prefer not to be on government programs. Most people would prefer to pay for health insurance themselves if they could. But the health insurance market doesn't allow most people to get health insurance, even if you have a full-time job
right.
at a minimum wage or a little bit more than minimum wage. It's simply impossible for you to pay for health insurance for you and your family.
Especially when you're talking about a nation that pays twice as much as every other industrialized nation in the world.
Yeah, I mean, we know there's a lot of things wrong with the healthcare system, and we know every other country provides universal coverage. This is a step toward universal coverage. This is what a decent, responsible political community does, and that's not their vision of what a good polity should look like. And the fact is, you know, if you actually provide people with health care, it actually makes it easier for them to work, and it keeps them healthier, it keeps them, you know, in better shape, they can work harder, they can work longer. Providing health care for people who are low-income workers will help businesses who hire them. I think, you know, any smart business person would say, well, if I can't provide health care for people, even, and some can because the tax credit in the Affordable Care Act, but still some can't. Any business would think, I would rather have employees with good health care.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I've never understood.
They're sick.
Yeah, but I've never understood awesome. Why employers want that responsibility. And I still see people fighting for this employer-based system, and I go, but why would they want it? They want to run their business. They don't want to have to deal with all of the other things unless it's a control factor.
Yeah, there are a lot of things that are going to happen in the healthcare system over the next 15 or 20 years. The Affordable Care Act has set in motion a lot of other reforms that will, I think, slow the growth in healthcare costs. And I think it will gradually move us away from an employer-based system, which I think is a good thing.
Yep.
But one way or the other, we've got to, in this transition period, make sure that we treat people decently, which means we have to make sure that if they can't afford health insurance on their own, that's available to them.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. And I understand tomorrow, 1 o'clock here in the Capitol, East Rotunda, main Capitol building, here in the Capitol, people from across the state are going to come to launch the Cover the Commonwealth campaign. Will you be here in our Capitol?
No, I'm afraid I won't be there. I have some other things I'm doing, but, you know, a lot of my friends are helping organize that effort. And there's a big coalition building of you know, labor unions and of businesses and certainly the hospitals. You know, and that's one thing we should mention. If the hospitals, if we don't get this Medicaid expansion, the hospitals are still going to lose like $8 billion a year because the federal government said, well, if we're insuring people, we don't have to give you so much money to cover people who are uninsured. Now, under the law, the hospitals are going to lose that money. Now, a lot of hospitals in the state, particularly those that treat a lot of people without insurance, desperately need that money, or they need people to have insurance. If the Medicaid expansion doesn't go through, those people won't have insurance. The hospitals will lose the money. There are some hospitals in cities, in suburban areas, in rural areas that may not make it. without this Medicaid expansion. So that's something else people should keep in mind. You may not need Medicaid, although a lot of middle class people need Medicaid for retirement and for retirement homes or when they get ill and aged. But you may not need Medicaid to get health care, but you need the Medicaid system to support hospitals in your area, or you might see your local hospital close.
Yeah, and because
we all need this.
There's the right-wing frame, and it was put out by George Bush, and it's put out by a lot of Republicans saying, well, we already have national health care, Mark. We've got it. You get sick? I mean, Mitt Romney brought it up. Have a heart attack? We're not going to let you die in your apartment. An ambulance will come get you and take you to the hospital, and you're covered.
Yeah, well, you may be covered to if they get you to the hospital and when they patch you up. But, you know, as soon as they patch you up, you've got to leave, and you're not covered for chronic care. You're not covered for ongoing care. And that adds enormously to the expenses of all of us. You know, the estimate that we had many years ago, and I just started working on this, is 12% of our insurance goes to cover care of people who don't have insurance, who get much more expensive care than they should be getting. So it's insuring everyone is part of containing costs.
So let me ask you
this. This is one piece of a really integrated program that's going to drive down costs of health care. It's going to drive down our insurance, or at least stop it from going up as fast as inflation. And by the way, that's already happening. We're getting health insurance and health care costs under control. It's simply terrible to say, to take this one important piece of a complicated piece of legislation, say we're not going to do it here because it might make other parts not work. And again, that's probably part of the Republican goal, to try to see what they can do to undermine this program.
So since you laid it out, look, I mean, the reality is it's going to create jobs, it's going to make sure people get covered, it's going to probably lower the cost for everybody across the board, it's going to save hospitals, it's going to help doctors. There's all this stuff that you've laid out. How do we make sure that happens? How do we push forward? How do we push this?
Well, you know what? People really need to talk to the state legislators, the state senators, their state representatives. Doesn't matter whether Democrats or Republicans. Some of the Republicans are so far to the right that their minds are closed.
Yep.
But there are Republicans around the state that still have a soul. There are Republicans who can listen to evidence, who can listen to reason. And those are the people we need to be talking to. A lot of them live in southeast Pennsylvania, but they're found all over the state. And I would really urge people to find a local group that's organizing on this. And if you can't find one, just call your state representative or state senator and say, look, I'm one of your constituents. We really need this Medicaid expansion, and I'm expecting you to vote for it.
We absolutely do. Mark Steer, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate the time.
I'm always happy to talk with you too, Rick. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much. Over 700,000 people could be covered by this. There's an opportunity to make sure that we have support, that we make sure that health security is a right. It's amazing. Tomorrow, 1 o'clock, in the Capitol, East Rotunda, the Capitol. Be there. We'll see you tomorrow. Quick break. Back with hour 2, 3. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to the Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. A restaurant receipt on which a customer complained of being charged an automatic gratuity was posted online and went viral the first week of February when the worker who posted it got fired. It jump-started a discussion about low-paid restaurant workers, their lack of job security, and the role of tipping. WIN's Melinda Tuhus has the story.
Chelsea Welch was working at an Applebee's restaurant in St. Louis, Missouri, when another server showed her the receipt, on which was scribbled, "I give 10% to God, why do you get 18?" and wrote Pastor next to it. Welch posted it on Reddit, trying to be careful not to reveal any personal information or even that it was an Applebee's receipt. When the pastor learned it had been posted, she demanded that everyone involved be fired.
My manager, who I adore, looks at me and says, "You're probably going to lose your job over this, and I'm sorry." Apparently, they get a hold of upper management, and they say, "Let her go. Let her go right now."
Welch says she was heartened by a friend and fellow employee who gave his 2 weeks' notice to quit in solidarity when she was fired, and by the global outpouring of support, including job offers from near and far. She also loved that one man went into an Applebee's, ordered a glass of water, and left a $10 tip with a nasty note to management referencing her firing. She thinks that would be more effective than a boycott, which has been proposed all over the web.
I've really not spoken out in favor of any boycotts of Applebee's because it punishes the people who have the job that I had. But something that sends the message to Applebee's that they probably took things a little too far. You know, there are far more disciplinary actions than just termination.
Tips supplement what's often a meager hourly wage. That federal minimum has not budged in 22 years. Chelsea Welch says all states should institute minimum wage for restaurant employees, and even that is far from a living wage. Melinda Tuhus, Workers Independent News.
This story was underwritten by a grant from the Burger Marks Foundation. Workers at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center who had been fired for their efforts to organize will be reinstated. SEIU Healthcare Pennsylvania is working with maintenance workers at the UPMC facilities who wish to have union representation. The union filed charges with the National Labor Relations Board against UPMC last year, alleging that nurses were inappropriately fired and that the medical organization had been using intimidation tactics against employees. According to the NLRB's Pittsburgh office, a settlement had been reached with UPMC, and they agreed to stop intimidating employees. Details of the settlement were not made publicly available, and both sides declined to comment on the full details. This newscast made possible in part through underwriting support from the IBEW. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The steel strike of 1919 was called the Hunky Strike because most of the workers were either first or second generation immigrants from Eastern and Central Europe. Up until the end of World War I, workers had benefited from shorter hours, better pay, and the promise of union recognition. Once the war came to an end, the mill owners pursued anti-union open shop policies and other cost-cutting measures. During the strike, there was near total suppression of all civil liberties. Major work issues included the 12-hour day, the 7-day work week, scores of workers being injured and maimed, union recognition, and poverty wages. Mary Harris, better known as Mother Jones, fought tirelessly throughout her life for social justice and human rights as a labor leader and a worker advocate. On August 20th, while visiting striking miners in Homestead, Pennsylvania, home of U.S. Steel's famous Homestead Steelworks, she defied injunctions against public gatherings and addressed 5,000 striking workers and their families. This speech led to her being arrested and jailed for giving an unauthorized speech. When brought before the judge, she was asked who had signed her permit to speak at a public gathering. She answered, Patrick Henry, Thomas Jefferson, and John Adams. As the strike went on, Mother Jones, the grandmother of all agitators, gave many speeches to rally the workers. One speech in Chicago was described by a spy for the U.S. War Department's Military Intelligence Division as the foulest and most profane that can be imagined, teeming with ultra-radical suggestions. Welcoming the spies, she would invite them to the front of the crowd so they could report her words accurately. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
I know many of you are going to be interested in this next subject. Pennsylvania sits within a day's drive of 60% of the nation's population. Every year, nearly $500 billion worth of goods and services move through our state transportation system. Transportation is the bloodstream of our economy. If it fails, our economy fails. However, as you know, the average in our state is 51 years old.
Well, you know, it's not just the walls here in the sinkhole capital of the state. 41 sinkholes in the last year. And you look at reports today at Penn Line. The last one, the one that almost swallowed up the garbage truck, Going to cost the city about $1.7 million that, oh, guess what? The city doesn't have. And we've got a governor who's right, and I agree with him. A lot of money comes through this area, 60% of the population within a day's drive, and guess what? If our infrastructure fails, he's right. Our economy fails. And I think what we should be doing, what we should be doing here in Harrisburg is having a sinkhole walking tour. Evidently 41 of them within walking distance. We can take the tour and look at the infrastructure failures because it's all the 120-year-old pipes underneath our roads. And I look at the money that he's put towards transportation, $1.8 billion over the next 5 years. Are you kidding me? Which is why workers from across the state, as we talked earlier, activists from across the state took to the Capitol for the rumble in the rotunda talking about public transit and investing it. I've got John Johnson, Jr., president of the Transportation Workers Local 234 from Philadelphia, who was one of the speakers today. John, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I look at this, and it was a fantastic event today. Hundreds of people from across the Commonwealth saying, you know what? We'd like public transportation, please.
It was remarkable.
And you look at what the governor said. If our infrastructure fails, our economy fails.
That's the message. I mean, when a governor says that to you, you have to sit back and listen and wonder, is he really serious? Because we are the lifeline, the bloodline that runs through the veins of the state of Pennsylvania. UTU 85 in Pittsburgh, TW Local 234 in Philadelphia. We touch every area of the state with our buses, trains, and trolleys.
Yeah, as somebody, I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland, and we weren't on the bus line. The buses didn't come through our neighborhood. So that lifeline, that opportunity line, if you will, wasn't there for us.
You know, that impacts people's ability to earn a living. If you're not on a bus route or a transportation route, you're limited as to where you can get to your job or get home. So that's what the governor meant when he said, we're the bloodstream of the state. If we don't build our transportation infrastructure up, how can we increase the jobs for truck drivers, bus operators? It doesn't make sense to me.
So when you look at our governor and, you know, someone that the chairman of the Republican Party called the greatest pro-growth, pro-jobs governor in our Commonwealth history, I'd love that to be true. Do you see that when he proposes $1.8 billion over the next 5 years in infrastructural spending on a demand that his commission says is about $6.5 billion?
No. He knows already that he's underfunding the transportation bill. That's a slap in our face if he thinks that we're going to believe a fallacy like that and accept it. It's not possible.
So when you look at this, what should people be thinking? What should people be doing? Because, you know, for me, I look to last year, for instance, when our General Assembly decided that they were going to pass a resolution making 2012 the year of the Bible. No transportation bill, no infrastructure bill. That was their best infrastructure plan. That they were going to help me pray a little bit more, that I make it from one end of the bridge to the other without going into the drink. What should people be thinking about when they see $1.8 billion on a $6.5 billion demand, when they see 2012, the year of the Bible, but no infrastructure spending? What should people be thinking?
Outrage.
And we saw that today. I mean, I was impressed by the number of riders from across the Commonwealth, folks who, activists from across the Commonwealth, who say, you know what, public transportation is important to my life. In fact, so important, I'm going to come from Pittsburgh or Philadelphia here to Harrisburg to say, I want my voice heard.
And our voices were heard. You had a number of speakers who spoke to those points that you raised. Again, transportation is the bloodstream of our state. If the governor wants to really increase our economic vitality, He has to invest in transportation. You're not going to build an apartment on a route that doesn't have service from public transportation. We have women and men that have to walk up hills in Pittsburgh, senior citizens, to get to their homes because their buses are no longer operating in that area. If he wants to help us out, he needs to put the money where the money belongs, and that's in transportation. That helps out the building and bridges, the other trades. We are one.
Right, absolutely. But here's the thing that gets me. I want the chairman of the GOP committee here to be, I want him to be right. I want this guy to be a job creator. I want him to be pro-growth. And I think in his speech he understands we're within a day's drive of 60% of the population.
Mm-hmm.
We have the first three things that any business is looking for when they're looking to go somewhere else. Location, mm-hmm. location, location. And yet, he seems to think it's tax cuts, handouts, and deregulation. There's something, there's a major disconnect with this guy.
You forgot one, outsourcing.
Well, and of course, the magic box there in the tax haven state known as Delaware.
Right.
So what should we be doing? I enjoyed the rally today. That was a great start. Where to from there?
Call your state rep. Call your state senators. Let them know that you're outraged by what the governor is proposing. The governor works for us. We tend to forget that at times because he is a governor. Votes count. He's up for re-election next year.
And not very popular right now.
No, I can't say. How can you be a popular governor when you're doing everything against your constituents? When you're literally hurting them?
Excellent point. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show here with John Johnson, Jr., president of the Transportation Workers Union, Local 234 in Philadelphia. Let me ask you, John, you know, a lot of the knock against public transportation in this state, especially in our listening area, is that it's a Philadelphia thing or it's a Pittsburgh thing. What's the argument for saying, you know what, public transit transportation is a statewide thing, it's a Pennsylvania thing? Make an argument for me.
I'll tell you right now, Philadelphia, TW Local 234, ATU 85 in Pittsburgh. There are other transit agencies within the state of Pennsylvania that one never hears about. So when you, if you hurt one, you hurt us all. Look what happened in Pittsburgh. They cut almost 50 to 75% of their workforce and outsourced it. That's coming to the Philadelphia area. That's why we're here now, to make sure that people understand you cannot cut transit and expect to be rewarded economically. It's not going to happen. And the governor has to understand that and realize that. If he has his lobbyists, his legislators, they know the truth is that you need transit.
So what do you say to the person who says, well, we just can't do it profitable? We have this business mentality. And look, a lot of people have this. Government should be run like a business. You know, I've listened to Daryl Metcalf talk about we should be the race leader to the race to the bottom, and we should be the ones destroying pensions, much like they do in the private sector. What do you say to that? I mean, is transit something that should be run for a profit, or is it something that's a part of the commons, something that we the people do for ourselves to move around so that I don't have 1,000 people in front of me wasting 5.5 billion hours a year sitting in traffic?
It's not possible. Before SEPTA became SEPTA, it was PTC, Philadelphia Transit Company. It went bankrupt. The state took it over. Why? Because it was not a profitable business. That's my argument right there. You've had companies, yeah, other transit agencies across the country that have become private. Now they're going to become public again because it's too much for one company to absorb the investment.
More than anything. I mean, because you're talking, when you're talking about the rails and you're talking about the constant upkeep, and it's a lot of investment. Which to me, we're not doing. And I just heard something tonight that they're talking about cutting the leg from Harrisburg to Pittsburgh on Amtrak, which seems to me to be, well, stupid.
It's asinine. Again, you're hurting yourself. It's like you're committing suicide. If you're saying we're the bloodline and you're cutting off the bloodstream, you're choking us. We're going to eventually die and wither to nothing. You cannot take away what people need to survive and also help our state grow.
What kind of organizing are we doing around? One of the campaigns that I talked to a woman earlier, Molly Nichols from Pittsburgh, who said, you know, they're organizing the riders. They're organizing people on the buses to say, look, you know, this is important to us. We need to have this for not only our jobs, but to get to the grocery store or, you know, to the hospital or to wherever. Are you doing much of that in Pittsburgh?
Well, in Pittsburgh, Molly.
Or, I mean, in Philadelphia. Sorry.
We're going to work with Molly to bring that template to Philadelphia to engage our ridership and let them know what's facing them if the governor's lack of investment in transportation happens.
Because I've got a theory, and when I was talking to Molly, this popped up. I mean, what we've seen the Republicans, and really the wealth class, if you will, what we've seen them do is destroying any opportunity where people come together to collectively discuss anything, where there's any organizing potential. I mean, I point to the unemployment offices that have all been shut down. We do that all online. There's no more welfare offices where people go to congregate. What we've done is we've shoved poor people and people in need to the periphery, where they're almost unorganizable. And I think public transportation, that's one of those things for me that I see them trying to do as well.
Divide and conquer. They're trying to do the same thing with transportation, the buildings department, and other unions. They're trying to have us fight against one another for what is rightfully ours, job security. They say, well, we won't fund building and bridges if we give transportation this. So now you have that union looking at us saying, you guys are taking from us. But now that we're all talking, because we are one, and we're engaging each other and letting everyone know what's taking place, so that they can't divide and conquer and pick us off like they would like to. We're making it very, very hard for them.
Yeah, I always go back to the robber baron from the 1880s and 1890s, Jay Gould, when he said, I could easily pay half the working class to kill the other half. Yeah. That is their M.O.
Most definitely.
So what do we do? What do citizens, what do you know, people who like me, who would love to have public transportation in my area, what do we do?
One thing, we have to make sure the governor knows that we want transportation. And that's what it comes back to that. The governor has to hear the voices of his constituents, not just a one-day rally. We have to do this on a consistent basis, rather it's calling the governor's office, letting him know, writing letters to the editors, making our voices heard, and hopefully our local media will cover and let them know to bring our message even further out there to the public.
Last line of questioning I've got for you. You know, you hear a lot about the budgets. You hear a lot about, you know, and especially on the national level, we're broke. We can't afford it. Can we afford it?
We can't afford not to invest in transportation. Again, it's the bloodstream, the lifeline of our state.
John Johnson, I appreciate the time. President of the Transportation Workers Local 234 there in Pittsburgh. I appreciate it. Thanks so much. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
This is why we fight, why we lie away. This is why we fight.
Finally, radio for the rest of us. Rick Smith.
Ask me, Council 13 members. Did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Since being thumped hard by voters last November, Republican leaders have gone through a period of reflection, introspection, and contemplation, and they now say they must make fundamental internal changes to become realistic political contenders. Does this mean they're finally going to quit being a political front for the Koch brothers' plutocratic fantasies, jettison their Tea Party nuttiness about everything from nullification to legitimate rape, or stop their destructive fixation on budget slashing? No, no, it's not their own deeply flawed fundamentals they intend to change, but the inner workings of America's election mechanics. The problem, they say, is not their unpopular policies or their offensive strategy of attacking whole swaths of the electorate, but that states are not allocating their electoral votes in ways that would throw the election to Republicans. For some time, we've seen GOP governors and election officials openly rigging rules and voting procedures to shut out students, minorities, seniors, and other likely Democratic voters from casting ballots. But now, Top Republicans are going all out to fix vote allocation rules in selected swing states, enabling their presidential candidates to, quote, win even though they lose. For example, last fall, Obama won Florida, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Wisconsin. But with Republicans in control of those state governments, the GOP is scheming to award the electoral votes of those states in the future not to the statewide winner, but to the winner in each congressional district. If it had been fully implemented for last year's election, this arbitrary slicing and dicing would have diverted enough electoral votes to Romney to hand him the presidency. This is Jim Hightower saying, for more on the GOP's plot to steal the White House, see a full report at AmericanProgressAction.org. That's AmericanProgressAction.org. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So I'm looking at the Governor's Transportation Commission's their findings. The Funding Advisory Commission report, if you will, officially called. And it points out that the governor's, what they've pointed out is by 2020, they're going to have $7.2 billion in need. That's what you're going to have. That's unmet. $7.2 billion of unmet needs. When it was done in 2010, when this report was done in 2010, it was $3.5 billion. So you think about this, and what I've been saying is, look, he's proposed $1.8 billion in funding for a public transportation system that, well, almost 3 years ago was $3.5 billion. So he barely funded half of what we needed 3 years ago. The report says 2010, $3.5 billion. So you push this forward 5 more years to 2018. We're right about $6.8 billion on $1.8 billion in funding, and that's just to keep pace. That's not to improve. That's not for innovation. That's not for getting things for the future. That's just right now, marching in place. And even they point out that as the roads degrade and the surfaces degrade, there are safety concerns. Vehicle maintenance costs are going to go up. They understand that we've got a huge number of structurally deficient bridges. They get it. And they say, look, you understand, congestion is going to increase. Because, well, we're not going to fund traffic signal improvements, appropriate capacity projects. We're not going to maintenance projects. We're not going to be building bigger infrastructure because we don't have the money. And I point to that report from Texas A&M. 5.5 billion hours American commuters sat in traffic, just sitting. 3 billion gallons of gasoline wasted. Just idling, just sitting there. And anybody who's ever gone into Washington during rush hour or into New York or Boston or San Francisco or any of these big cities, Houston, Los Angeles, you know, you sit in traffic, you could be there hours. And I've always wondered why we haven't, as a nation, embraced this idea of we need to have more public transportation and lots of it. Because it is, it's a great job creator. And it's a consistent job creator. It's something that we need more of. Even if you're not going to be the one who takes it. And look, when I lived in Cleveland, you had the RTA there. I would park at one of the substations out of town. I would take the train into downtown. And I was in and out, bang, bang. I wasn't sitting on the highway for an hour or two or whatever, in and out. But even if I weren't one of the people who would want to be on the train, wouldn't I want to get the guy in front of me off the road? I mean, there are so many positives to this. But yet, again, we've got a guy who really, honestly and truthfully, I think Mark Steer was right. It's about the desperation class. It's about squeezing every last bit of profit for a handful. Can you think of any other reason? Because I can't. I look at what this guy has done. I look what the Republicans have done for the last couple of years. And it just leaves me scratching my head that this is not the party of Lincoln. And I know last Friday they had the big Lincoln dinner. This is not the party of Lincoln. This is not the party of Eisenhower. This is not even the party of Reagan. As radical as Reagan was for his day, this is not his party. In fact, I would even argue that Obama was probably to the right of Reagan on some things, which is how far the goalposts have been moved. Because we used to think about the commons. We used to think about all of us. And I really, there's part of me that I'm thinking this theory through. That, you know, buses are one of those places where people congregate. They're together for a couple of minutes. There's an opportunity for people to say, hey, you know what? What do you think? We can't have that. So I'm left with this uneasy feeling. Because while I saw a great, enthused bunch of people here today in the Capitol saying, we want transit. We want this for not only ourselves, but for our community. I saw the lieutenant governor walk by with a big smirk on his face. You know, like he knows he's in on the secret. And the secret is, all you people in the rotunda, you're getting screwed. And all of us, all of the people who work, we're getting screwed. Because that isn't part of their agenda. Their agenda has been laid out for them. And I'm going to remember this. John Taylor, the Republican representative out of the Philadelphia area, said, look, he's not been a part of any of the, his caucus hasn't been a part of any privatization discussions. I look at the governor's, his advisory commission's report, and P3s are a part of it. Public-private partnerships. It's the private part that gets me. Because I think like John Johnson Jr. said, and I believe him, and I've had some people try and make an argument that you can run public transportation for a profit. I don't believe it, and I don't think it's a good idea to even make the argument that you can. It's for the common good. Like, I don't think we can run roads and bridges for a profit, nor do I think we should. Nor do I think we should run education for a profit or health care for a profit. I think it's part of who we should be. It's part of the commons. It's part of what we do for ourselves. It's part of our society. It's part of the legacy that we leave for our children in the next generation. All of that infrastructure, the airports, should we be running that stuff for profit? I know they're trying. They're trying to suck every dime out of it so that we can hand off, we can pay homage to the chair. I just don't think it's such a good idea. And for me, it's all part of that no rights at work agenda. Whether it's taking my right to collective bargaining away, or it's destroying my right to be a member of a labor union, or it's taking education away from my kids, or health care away from my family, or retirement security away, or any of that stuff. It's all part of the assault that we have seen masterfully put forth, funded, and hammered out by the radical right, the extreme right. Now, there, fortunately, in this state, there are some Republicans who, they're not on board with that. Yet. My fear is that when the money starts really hammering in here, because Wisconsin did happen, and Indiana did happen, and Michigan happened, and all of the things that we've been seeing around, now the money's going to turn its sights here. Are we prepared for that? Because when the barrage begins, when the messaging begins, when the constant ad nauseum attacks begin, we have to fall back on what we know. We have to fall back on our filters. And we have to be the ones to turn it back and to say no, no, no. It's that simple, folks. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Earth, sky.
Scientists at Rice University say that skin cells coordinate their motions as they race to cover and ultimately heal wounds. They say this motion can be compared to the way birds swoop and flock in unison.
Previously, it was thought that only the cells at the edge of a wound were actively moving. Dividing cells were thought to passively fill in the middle of a wound. But the researchers at Rice say they've learned that skin heals more efficiently if highly activated cells in every part of a wound exert force as they pull neighboring cells along.
These scientists use a computer model to analyze the physics of cell physical interactions with their neighbor cells in your skin. Part of their goal was to create an integrated way of thinking about how your skin heals itself. The researchers looked to the skies for inspiration. To the way some species of birds flock and move in unison. Like flocks of birds, they said, cells coordinate their motions in order to heal a wound. They said your skin cells see their neighbors, which they described as sticky, and they said each cell pulls and tugs its neighbors in the process of healing skin.
The researchers said that their computer modeling work has a long way to go, but ultimately, they hope to match their models to current work by experimentalists on the movement of cells related to the spread of breast cancer. For more, come to earthsky.org and search for the words cells flock. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution sounds. Don't you know,
together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show. Progressive talk with a conscience.
Crying at the doorsteps of the armies of salvation. Wasting time in the unemployment lines. Sitting around, waiting for a promotion.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Our quote of the day comes from an editorial in the Concord Monitor from the past week. It said, bending the curve of what looks like to be a bleak future will require cooperation and concerted action, starting with the United States. That action is being thwarted by the concentration of wealth in the hands of the few. And you look at this at every turn, what we're seeing is, well, we've got to pay homage to the chair. We've got to make sure that the special interests are fed, the very top of the chain fed. Before we can start talking about anything. And that's education, that's healthcare, that's public transit, that's any of that. We've got to make sure the well-heeled are, well, healed. and there's something seriously wrong. And I look at this, tomorrow night going to be the big State of the Union address. What's the president going to talk about? I know during the election, we didn't talk about poverty hardly at all. And when we pointed that out locally, the local newspaper, the Patriot News, said we did an article back in 2010 written by the Tea Party think tank, the Commonwealth Foundation, but they published it. And then they said, well, here's another link that they did 3 years before that. But they did do 98 stories on the farm show. So you decide, poverty or the farm show? Which is more important? I kind of wonder what's going to happen tomorrow night, which is why we've asked Eric Stegman, manager of the Half in 10 campaign, halfin10.org, the website, to come talk to us about poverty and the direction our nation should be taking. Eric, thanks for taking time for me.
Sure, happy to be with you.
So I look at the election. I'm looking at what's going on right now. Poverty not high on the list of topics being discussed. In fact, the only thing I really remember when we discussed poverty at all in the last election was Governor Romney talking about the 47% of folks who don't earn enough money to pay federal income tax.
Yeah, I think that it's been really interesting to see what's been going on since the election in how we've been discussing or not discussing the issue of poverty. We really were hoping that, especially when we saw the new numbers come out, that this whole topic of inequality would have actually come to the forefront, because a lot of what we actually saw in the numbers was exactly what was the substance of the election, but really no one wanted to talk about poverty. You know, you hear a lot of references to, you know, the middle class, the 47%, all these others, but really when it boils down to it, we still rarely hear that.
Well, I mean, and that's an excellent point, because I don't believe people think that they're not in the middle class. I think we've been sold for so long that, you know, and I remember a woman I met at a gas station a couple of years back, made $16,000 a year, and she believed she was in the middle class because she didn't ask for any handouts from government that she knew of. But when you went through some stuff, I do get that. But she, in her mind, she wasn't one of those 47%.
Yeah, and I can tell you one of the things, we come out with a report every year tracking our progress and our goal to cut poverty in half in 10 years, and one of the biggest things that came out this year in our report was that the economy grew, but so did income inequality. So even though the economy's been growing for way too many Americans in this country, they're still not feeling it. In fact, the top 20% saw income gains in 2011, while incomes fell or stagnated for all the low and middle income families. So lower and middle income families do have a lot in common in that they're not feeling any of this economic growth.
Yeah, I've been saying for a while, the recovery happened.
Yep.
We just didn't share in it.
Exactly.
So what do you say to the person who says, well, you know, Eric, you're just talking class war. You're just jealous.
I think that there's a few things that I would definitely respond to on that level. One, there's a certain kind of income in this country that we also found in our report that we've unfortunately been finding for over a decade has not changed one bit, and that's service incomes. I think there are so many pieces to the American dream that are really built on the service economy, and while we've seen wages rise in those top 20%, service incomes have stayed stagnant, in some cases gone down. And when you look at it, in a lot of cases, for some of the states that have been struggling the most, those service incomes are actually some of the ones that don't even qualify for unemployment insurance. So when we're talking about trying to make sure that everyone's got an equal chance to get a leg up and be part of this economy and be part of this economic growth, there are so few avenues for people to really be able to build that part back into their economy. So I just don't see it as – I see it as a fairness issue. I think all of us see it as a fairness issue, that this is not anything about class warfare. This is about making sure that everyone's got the same opportunity to join this country's shared prosperity.
So the guy working at the drive-through window at my local McDonald's, his having to work a million hours – in a year to make the same amount of money that the CEO makes, you don't think that's fair?
Yeah, I don't understand how most reasonable people would think that's fair.
and I'm with you. So for me, it comes down to how do we make those jobs the next generation of livable jobs? Because you go back to the mining jobs 100 years ago, the factory work jobs 100 years ago, those Those were pittance. Those were barely able to exist and scrape by kind of jobs. It was because workers organized and joined unions and said and demanded part of the wealth that they created. I see the same thing at the McDonald's and at the Walmarts and the big box retailers. I see that as the fight of this generation.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of really important pieces about it. One is that we certainly need a good living wage, and I think that there are certain places that have really stood up and said that we want to provide a livable wage for the people who are in any of these sectors. I think the federal minimum wage needs to be raised. On the other level, I think we've got to look at some of the things we've already seen benefits for. One of the other things that we saw in our report this year is that the number of uninsured Americans actually went down for the first time in 2011 after several years. And we really believe that those are some of the early benefits of the Affordable Care Act. And I think that as we start to look at ways that we can provide some of these other, things like health insurance, unemployment insurance, ways that people cannot just, make sure that their wages are going a little bit further for their families, they're also providing a pathway into other opportunities. And I think that one of the things that we're going to see in the next couple of years here being discussed heavily is education. It's another thing that has not been discussed at all. If you remember the last several years, we saw education reform completely stall in Congress. And there are a lot of different needs for, especially for some of these employees in some of these later skill training situations, that we really need to think differently about how we train our workforce, and we need to make sure that people have an actual pathway
right
into some of these kinds of professions.
That, and there's a whole bunch to that as well. I mean, when you start looking at the way we have funded higher education and the way we've funded education in this country, there's an awful lot to that as well.
Yeah, and one of the things that I do hope to hear another push coming from the president, other than just talking about some of these important programs that really support struggling families, is going back to his Pathways Back to Work initiative. There were a lot of really important things in that bill that he had proposed that really would have given a lot of these employees who are struggling in some of these sectors a leg up in the world, especially in some of the regions that they live in, because a lot of them really do have the capability to work in much better paying jobs, but we don't have the kinds of skills training initiatives that we need. We're not putting the kind of funding behind it that we need. And those are really the ones who are going to be helping us continue to innovate in our economy, but we really need to help retrain our workforce.
Yeah, I wish we could do that, though, but the Republicans keep telling them we're broke, Eric.
Yeah, and I think one of the things, as we mentioned before, is it's clear that our economy is growing, and I think that right now we're really at a fork in the road. In one level, it's about, okay, we can make investments in our future, and we can still reduce the deficit responsibly. The Center for American Progress came out with a plan that showed that we can reduce the deficit over 10 years by making responsible choices around how we cut our budget, but still invest in important things like education, infrastructure, and several other areas that we need to do, because the longer that we starve ourselves of these important investments, we're really actually falling down on ourselves with the economy in the future, especially for Americans who are already struggling. You know, those who have been seeing income gains in the top 20% even through the recession aren't the ones who are feeling this. And so the ones who really need the investment are those who've been seeing either stagnant or falling wages over all these years.
So you expect this is what we're going to hear from the president tomorrow, because I expect him to say a lot about creating jobs. And my question is, what kind of jobs are we talking about? If we're talking more minimum wage, more service sector jobs, that I don't know that's going to really boost our economy that much.
I agree, and I think one of the things that we're hoping that we see out of the address tomorrow is that we saw the beginnings of some really important principles that were being outlined in his inaugural address, particularly as they related to poverty. What we're hoping is that we see some true solutions outlined. One of the things that our advocates on the ground have really been pushing for a while is this Talk Poverty social media movement, where it was started by Greg Kaufman at The Nation magazine online, who writes a poverty column, back during the election. And we actually ended up doing a spin-off social media campaign where we had people tweeting and Facebooking about, we want to hear about poverty, and we know the solutions. We know what's worked. You know, this country used to be in a horrible position back when LBJ declared a war against poverty. And we turned that around, and we cut the poverty rate in half, not just once, but twice in this country in some very difficult times. So we know we can do it. We know what the solutions are. We've lifted millions of people out of poverty through a number of really important programs. But what we need right now is leadership. And so we're really hoping that we see the president standing up tomorrow and outlining actual policy solutions to build on the principles that he brought up during his inaugural address.
So we can get to work organizing, make sure that that happens. But what do you say to the folks who, and I've had this argument a number of times about the Great Society and the push that LBJ did, that it actually made the country more dependent. And there's a fear because, you know, there's fear we're going to be a socialist society. We're going to be like those people, those Europeans who, you know, the austerity thing working really well for them, by the way. But we're going to be like that.
Yeah, there's, you know, and none of that is true. I mean, one of the things about, one of the issues right now with the poverty line is that most people don't really understand it. You've got a lot of people who are really struggling. They're struggling because of these stagnant service incomes. They're struggling because they lack that extra step of education they need in their job. And what they need are these critical federal programs that help make sure that their kids are being fed, that families are getting the support that they need, but that they also have that support that lifts them into that next stage of their careers, that lifts them into that next stage of their education. You know, most of these programs, you have to be working already to even receive these benefits, and yep. It's a total myth out there that a lot of conservatives spread around that there aren't work requirements attached to a lot of these. And I'm sure you feel the same way. You talk to enough people who have benefited from these programs, they don't want to just sit around and receive benefits for nothing. You know, most of these people want a prosperous future for their families, and they want the same fair opportunity to be part of this economy, and these programs are really a bridge to that. And I think we need to continue to provide those. And some of the ones that are really missing are things like education, because it takes a full spectrum of programs to really help make sure that people have that pathway, and we're not providing it right now.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. But here's the thing. I'm one of those people that you're talking about. I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland as a kid. I remember the programs of the Great Society. I remember the 70s where you would go to the local public school during the summertime, and they would have a hot lunch for kids. And for a lot of those kids in my neighborhood, it was the only hot meal they had.
Mm-hmm.
And then in came Reagan and the Reagan Revolution, and all of those kids were kicked to the curb, and all of those programs were eviscerated. And, oh, by the way, ketchup's a vegetable. That's what I remember. And I remember, and maybe it was just me growing up at the time I did, where I saw that government policy, that smart policy, made people's lives better.
Well, one thing that I think is really starting to change is that, fortunately, we're starting to track this differently. The Census Bureau just started a new way of tracking the poverty measure a couple of years ago called the Supplemental Poverty Measure, and it's really critical because one of the things we learned, for instance, is that the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which is food stamps, lifted 4.7 million people above the poverty line just in 2011. And tax credits, which were just extended under the new package, like the Earned Income Tax Credit and the Child Tax Credit, kept 8.7 million people out of poverty in 2011. And we are able to look at this now because we're looking at how these kinds of supports actually factor into a family's budget. And unfortunately, one of the things that's not changed over many years is that we're looking at poverty like it's just about, you know, having a certain kind of income. But we're not looking about what it means to raise a child, what it means to be able to go to school, what it means to put healthy food on the table. And we need to look at all of those, because when we actually see these programs and how they benefit families, and how they support children, how they support working families getting into the next careers that they need to get into, that's how we're going to be able to track our progress, and I think a lot of people lose track of that.
Yeah, and you brought up the Earned Income Tax Credit. Most people, especially my conservative friends, are shocked when I tell them it was the sainted Reagan who brought that existence and called it one of the a sweeping victory for fairness and perhaps the biggest anti-poverty program in our history, and a whole bunch of other things. Smartest thing to come out of the Congress, best worker family thing out of Congress. They're often shocked at that.
Yeah, they often are, and we definitely have the numbers to show it, and I'm glad, even though it was a struggle, unfortunately, we only got those extended for 5 years, whereas the tax cuts for the wealthy ended up getting extended permanently. One of the things I'll tell you, though, that I'm really keeping my eye on right now that I think is going to be a really important fight are child care programs, and we're seeing a lot of states really have to clamp down on those because the federal funding is continuing to diminish. And, you know, that's a really, really difficult thing for a lot of families to be able to struggle with when you need to go to work and you have to be at work at a certain time. You know, you can't make up excuses and you have absolutely no ability to, you know, care for your child. And some of these, like the child tax credit, are really important support, but we're seeing diminishing funding going toward the federal child care programs, and I think that that's something we really need to see some leadership on.
Yeah, because we're the country of family values.
Yes, exactly. And if we're the country of family values, you know, how are we expecting that families are going to be able to work when their kids aren't being able to, you know, get quality health or quality child care, quality food on their table? I mean, you even see conservatives going after the school lunch program now, which, as you mentioned, for a lot of kids, that's their only healthy meal during a day, and I just don't understand it.
But here again, it's family values for my family. The hell with yours.
Yeah.
That's the way it goes. Halfin10.org, the website. Eric Stegman, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much. Have a good evening.
Quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get The Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children. AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Seems like things are kind of upside down. Joke with you, someone to turn around. Oh, okay. He's done it before, he can do it again. This train's coming to town like a hurricane. Oh,
Yeah, the Herman Train. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Our stat of the day comes from the folks on the Too Much Online blog. They write, in 2011, new analysis of the latest released IRS data shows America's most affluent, the 1%, averaged $4.977 million, a 299% increase over the top 1% average than 50 years ago. Between 1961 and 2011, the average inflation-adjusted income of America's bottom 99%, well, that rose just 22%. And you go back to what we were talking about. You know, as we have seen this inequality explode before our very eyes, I love hearing tea people tell me, well, you're talking about redistribution of wealth. And I, most of the time, I just sit there with, stand there with my jaw agape going, where do you exist? Where is your head? Maybe if you pulled it out of you know where, you would see that we have created the largest billionaire class in the history of civilization. And how have we done that? We have done that off of retirement security, health security, a decent wage for the vast majority of working people in this country. We have done this through numerous free trade agreements, outsourcing, you name it, we have figured out how to push this race to the bottom. Because it's in the name of competition. Don't you believe in competition, Rick? Don't you believe in good-spirited, honest competition? It's the American way, don't you know? We need to have competition. Competition's good. And I agree, competition's good when you're both on the same plane. I don't know about you, but I don't know that you could really compete with billionaire money. And you go, well, but there's more of us. And you would think that would be enough, that there are more of us, that more of us can vote. But you look at how easily it is that they divide us. On public transportation, for instance, had a conversation with a guy today, said, you know, well, I'll never use it. Why should we have it? Why should I have to pay for that? Without narrow self-interest. And then I threw up, well, you know, the guy in front of you, that whole thing, it's going to get more traffic off the road. It's going to make commutes quicker because, hey, we've 5.5 billion hours sitting in traffic, 3 billion gallons of gas wasted. You know, there are all of these things. Since you need to boil things down in everyone's narrow self-interest, and just saying, it's good for society. It's good for all of us. It's good for the environment. It's smart policy. It's sound policy. It's things that we should be doing. And I go back to my grandfather's generation, who, you know, I think instinctively, and I think it was part of being part of that World War II generation, you did things because they were right. Because the old man always talked to me about doing what was right. And he always defined it that, you know, if you got to turn around and look, make sure your mother's not watching, then you're probably not doing something right. And I gotta wonder, in looking at these last couple of budgets, I wonder if Corbett's looking over his shoulder. Because these are definitely, definitely not right. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. Also, if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app. Take the program on the go. You can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. We're going to take a quick break. Back with Hour 3. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. But after all, something is simple.
It was rock and roll.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
A restaurant receipt on which a customer complained of being charged an automatic gratuity was posted online and went viral the first week of February when the worker who posted it got fired. It jump-started a discussion about low-paid restaurant workers, their lack of job security, and the role of tipping. WIN's Melinda Tuhus has the story.
Chelsea Welch was working at an Applebee's restaurant in St. Louis, Missouri, when another server showed her the receipt on which was scribbled, "I give 10% to God, why do you get 18?" and wrote "Pastor" next to it. Welch posted it on Reddit, trying to be careful not to reveal any personal information or even that it was an Applebee's receipt. When the pastor learned it had been posted, she demanded that everyone involved be fired.
My manager, who I adore, looks at me and says, "You're probably going to lose your job over this, and I'm sorry." Apparently, they get a hold of upper management, and they say, "Let her go. Let her go right now."
Welch says she was heartened by a friend and fellow employee who gave his 2 weeks' notice to quit in solidarity when she was fired, and by the global outpouring of support, including job offers from near and far. She also loved that one man went into an Applebee's, ordered a glass of water, and left a $10 tip with a nasty note to management referencing her firing. She thinks that would be more effective than a boycott, which has been proposed all over the web.
I've really not spoken out in favor of any boycotts of Applebee's because it punishes the people who have the job that I had. But something that sends the message to Applebee's that they probably took things a little too far. You know, there are far more disciplinary actions than just termination.
Tips supplement what's often a meager hourly wage. That federal minimum has not budged in 22 years. Chelsea Welch says all states should institute minimum wage for restaurant employees, and even that is far from a living wage. Melinda Tuhus, Workers Independent News.
This story was underwritten by a grant from the Burger Marx Foundation. Workers at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center who had been fired for their efforts to organize will be reinstated. SEIU Healthcare Pennsylvania is working with maintenance workers at the UPMC facilities who wish to have union representation. The union filed charges with the National Labor Relations Board against UPMC last year, alleging that nurses were inappropriately fired and that the medical organization had been using intimidation tactics against employees. According to the NLRB's Pittsburgh office, a settlement had been reached with UPMC, and they agreed to stop intimidating employees. Details of the settlement were not made publicly available, and both sides declined to comment on the full details. This newscast made possible in part through underwriting support from the IBEW. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Keep reiterating that the students aren't going to take it. Like, we're not going to take it. Like, not in the literal sense. I'm serious. We need to have this solidarity.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. That was a kid named Obonateria, senior at Garfield High School out there in Washington. He is the student body president. Look, you know, like he said, you know, they've reiterated it. Students aren't going to take it. No, not going to take it. Not literally, not figuratively. We need to have solidarity, and I couldn't agree more. And I look at this, and it's something that my wife and I have been weighing, the standardized tests. If we're gonna have allow our daughter to take it, I like the fact that finally we're starting to see parents and teachers and communities saying, you know what, all of this testing, all of this standardized, is this really a good use of our resources? Is this the best way to educate our children? I don't think so. Which is why I've asked Adam Gish. He's a teacher at Garfield High School. Adam, thanks for taking time for me.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on.
You know, I look at this, and I guess the question is are you against all high-stakes testing, or is it just a particular one that's in your school?
let me just start off by saying you don't fatten a pig by weighing it. That said, I am not against all testing. And I have to say, compared to the WASL, I look back now with a certain fondness, because at least I was able to teach the kids about what they were going to be tested. That I cannot say for the math. And so let me just stick with what we've been arguing against at Garfield, which is that the math is, at our level, ineffective.
Right. So what are you guys doing there? What is the push right now?
The push right now is that we are not going to take it. I mean, we're not going to administer it. It's been put onto the shoulders of the administration to administer it, with a lot of, I think, unpleasant coercion involved with that. We, I think, are technically supposed to give it a third time, and those of us who have refused to give it this time, I think, will continue to refuse to give it.
And can anyone be fired for refusing to give these tests?
I'm not sure, although Superintendent Bonda's initial reaction to suspend us for 10 days without pay has been taken off the plate at the moment.
Probably because all of your teachers are on board with this, correct?
Yes.
And it's that kind of solidarity I think you need to have in order for something for this to work. But I look at this test, this MAP test you're talking about. What is it?
It's a computerized test, an adaptive test, which means for reading and math, kids go in and they sit in front of a computer. For English, they'll read a section and then press a button to choose what they think the right answer is. If the answer is right, the questions all of a sudden become more difficult, and if wrong, easier. And
what's the point of that? I mean, is the point of that so that we get better test scores?
I think it's to figure out more precisely where students are at that particular moment.
Okay, and what would be the argument for that? I mean, because I can think, well, we need to know assessing where kids are so we know what to work on. Is that what it's used for?
That's what I think the original intent is to figure out so you can differentiate instruction and not be teaching kids things that are too hard for them and vice versa. However, because there is very little understanding of what is on the test, kids are often thrust in front of the computer. They'll press a button, and they will, if they guess it right, then be vaulted into an area for which they've had absolutely no instruction, and then they're stuck with not being able to comprehend, having no idea, and then they get it wrong, or maybe they get it right through guessing, and they go to something even harder. And so the thing is fraught with things that you would not really want someone to do in a testing environment.
Right. And how much of this is tied to their grade? Anything?
Not a thing.
So there's no there. So if I were a high school student, I could go in there and I could just say, I'm going to pick answer A for everything. I don't care.
And that's, there's a long history of that being done way before we decided to do what we're doing.
So now when I hear the right and the privatized education people here who keep saying we need to tie teacher compensation to these high-stake tests, your pay would basically be based on me going, I'm gonna guess A.
Yes. And if you'll notice, you don't see people from Lakeside or Bush rushing over and asking us to, you know, send the latest copy of the MAP test over for them so they can use it.
And Lakeside or Bush, I would assume, in your area are the more affluent areas.
Yeah, Lakeside is where Bill Gates went to school.
Oh, nice. I'm sure that... Now, do they have these standardized tests? Do they subject the Bill Gates of the future to these things?
I couldn't imagine any of the parents tolerating that.
So why then would we tolerate it for anybody's kids? I mean, because I got to be honest, I'm personally thinking that it's a waste of time, especially when you're talking about the results for the test that my kids will take aren't going to come out till next fall, to the following year. So I see absolutely no real rationale in why they have to take them and why waste the class time. We should be teaching them something else, in my view.
Well, the late superintendent of our district, who was on the board of directors, at that time, is the one who brought the MAP test to Seattle. That was found to be a conflict of interest. I'm assuming there are millions and millions of dollars, and not just with MAP, to be made from foisting unnecessary things on public schools.
I mean, we now have 2+2 being proprietary information, being something that we have to pay to a big for-profit multinational corporation.
Mm-hmm. No, it's and once people find out about it here, once parents find out about it, there, you know, about all of the inconsistencies and the reasons why, and again, at the high school level for us at Garfield, it is, it's not worth doing. Nobody is clamoring to take the test. In fact, I don't know if you're old enough to remember the old Batman, but there was a bat phone for the, you know, the special occasions. Well, we kind of have a map phone at Garfield.
Nice.
And, you know, when I called Verizon, none of our minutes have been used yet.
Yeah, excellent. Because, you know, there's part of me, and I've asked several parents, because, you know, I think it's going to be something that has to be done at the parental level. And I give you guys as teachers the ultimate credit of standing up and protecting your students and really protecting class time, because I can't imagine how much time do you guys spend on prepping for these tests.
Well, for certain tests, for example, our what is now the HISP, what used to be called the WASL, there was some test preparation that could be done, but it was much more clearly aligned with what the kids needed to know in terms of state standards, in terms of different kinds of writing, and so that was much more easy and credible to participate in. For this, honestly, I've never spent any time, because there was never any kind of training which told me, well, it's aligned to this, or these are the kinds of questions, these are the areas in which you need to address so the kids will be ready for that. None of that was ever brought up, because the purveyors of the test marketed it as a formative assessment, something that you use as an indicator of where kids might be. But there was, again, since you didn't know what you were really teaching towards, and there was not much time spent by the district informing us, I don't remember trainings for this, then what's the point? There was nothing. There was nothing really breathing down our backs to prepare the kids for a test that we saw had no value.
Yeah, because I look at this from my standpoint. And, you know, I'm a parent of three kids who are going to school, and you know, you go, what's the value in it for putting them through this stress? I mean, my oldest daughter, she doesn't want to take the test because she doesn't see that it's going to do her any good. I look at it as I want to make sure that I get the best for my kids, and I think most parents do. So when we hear these tests are going to assess where they are, we want to make sure that they're on track. We hear those things. We go, yeah, we're with you, until you hear we don't find out the assessments for months. And there's no.
Well, not only do we not find out about the results for months, but the results themselves are often not very useful. I don't know if you're familiar with Finnish Lessons, it's a book by Pasi Stolberg, but, you know, Finland has these amazing test results, educational outcomes, and they do almost none of what we are doing. And so, you know, what we say we want versus what we do, you can drive a truck through the gap. And I think as long as we can drive a truck through that gap, what we like to call the achievement gap, which I like to call better the human gap, will remain open. Because it's public schools who are being inundated with these kind of burdens, as I said before.
It's not the charters.
Yeah, well, I doubt if charters would use them either, because probably there are a couple of people smart enough running those who recognize that they're not the answer. So seeing that they're less encumbered by some of the rules than the more traditional public schools, why would they use them?
So what we as parents, what should we be asking for? What should we be demanding? Because, you know, look, we all want the best for our kids. Obviously, what does Finland do that we don't do? What should we be doing?
What does Finland do? They trust teachers. They pay teachers and train teachers at a much higher level than we do here. So they're on par with doctors and lawyers. It's hard to name all of the things that they do that we don't.
I think that the one you just laid out there is never going to work, because we like to think of educators as factory workers and those little vessels that come before them, you know, just little empty vessels that you guys, like punch press operators, just pour facts and punch the information in their heads, and every kid's the same, and it's this factory, this manufacturing type model.
And actually, when you take a look at good private schools, as I said before, they're doing none of this high-stakes testing. They're doing portfolios and project-based learning, where the kids are actually doing the things that they will want to be able to do as they get older.
Which is why I've always been a supporter of Montessori-type education. If we could afford it, that's what I would have done with the kids. But, you know, there were none in our area. But to me, it's that exact mentality. The project-based ideas, the portfolios, working towards something that interests them, teaching them how to learn, not so much regurgitating fact.
Exactly. And when you have a child who's interested in and believes in what he or she is doing, then you don't have classroom management issues, and you have somebody who is actually gaining in confidence rather than someone who says, well, I have a 98% or a 433, which may have nothing to do with anything that they're actually ever going to use.
So let me ask you, Adam, I see this national opt-out movement going across the country, and I know you guys are scrapped the map. What should parents be doing? What mobilization would you like to see? What are you seeing in the days and months ahead?
I think one of the most important things that can be done right now is, and you can get it through information here in Seattle, but find out a little bit about the testing, and if you agree that they are not doing what they're supposed to do, then tell somebody who you know doesn't know, and it's really going to be word of mouth, in which, you know, in the weeks, you know, that come, that there are 10 people who you know didn't know that they know and that they pass it on, so that you build a broad base of knowledge that's based on there are, I think, enough facts to back up our claims to show that this really is a tremendous waste of human energy
and money and resources.
And money. And when you look at it, and I know a big purveyor of testing and teacher evaluation is Bobby Jindal down in Louisiana, if it weren't so sad, his thrust to send us back to the 19th century where, you know, people have no dignity and we prepare kids for jobs in Walmart, that's really what we're fighting against. So, if we can spread the word coherently and with enough passion but also clarity so that people really understand that this is it's kind of a national threat that we're being subjected to so much time that does not involve real teaching.
Because it's my understanding that, you know, a lot of this, if you look at No Child Left Behind and this whole push for AYP and funding levels that go down as you don't meet this AYP, the average yearly progress, that you actually, based on some of this testing, and correct me if I'm wrong, you can actually start losing funding if these test scores don't continually go up, and at some point they want you to hit 100%, which I don't ever think is possible.
Well, and I'd like to think that the absurdity of the situation would become so blatantly clear prior to that. In fact, I think, you know, there's a push in Texas from Republicans to really back down and perhaps not test as much. So if they have gotten wind of this, then I guess either the window is open or people are seeing the emperor without the clothes.
Yeah, for me it comes down to if only we would have spent the effort, the resource, the time, the money, and all that we've wasted on this, on actually doing the things that we know work, smaller class sizes, better teachers, better training, those things, I think we'd be much further ahead.
Well, there's no irony, or perhaps there is, in the fact that In God We Trust is printed on the dollar bill.
Good point. Adam Gish, I appreciate the time. Keep up the fight, and I'd love to talk to you again at some point.
Thank you. Have a good night.
Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do.
men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by Ask Me Council 13.
Since being thumped hard by voters last November, Republican leaders have gone through a period of reflection, introspection, and contemplation. And they now say they must make fundamental internal changes to become realistic political contenders. Does this mean they're finally going to quit being a political front for the Koch brothers' plutocratic fantasies? Jettison their Tea Party nuttiness about everything from nullification to legitimate rape? Or stop their destructive fixation on budget slashing? No, no, it's not their own deeply flawed fundamentals they intend to change, but the inner workings of America's election mechanics. The problem, they say, is not their unpopular policies or their offensive strategy of attacking whole swaths of the electorate, but that states are not allocating their electoral votes in ways that would throw the election to Republicans. For some time, we've seen GOP governors and election officials openly rigging rules and voting procedures to shut out students, minorities, seniors, and other likely Democratic voters from casting ballots. But now, top Republicans are going all out to fix vote allocation rules in selected swing states, enabling their presidential candidates to, quote, win even though they lose. For example, last fall, Obama won Florida, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Wisconsin. But with Republicans in control of those state governments, the GOP is scheming to award the electoral votes of those states in the future not to the statewide winner, but to the winner in each congressional district. If it had been fully implemented for last year's election, this arbitrary slicing and dicing would have diverted enough electoral votes to Romney to hand him the presidency. This is Jim Hightower saying, for more on the GOP's plot to steal the White House, see a full report at AmericanProgressAction.org. That's AmericanProgressAction.org. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
We can't live in the wealthiest economy in the world, the richest nation in the world, and treat our workers like they're from the third world. Corporations are making profits hand over fist. They're sitting on tens of billions of dollars in cash that they refuse to put back into the economy. They're suppressing workers, banning them from being able to support their families.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. You know, I look at this and it just blows my mind. The numbers and this gap, you know, and it's on every front, whether it's education, whether it's on the job, the education. And I think Adam Gish hit on something that really caught my attention. It was this statement, you know, they don't do it in the schools that Bill Gates went to. Just like they in Chicago, they don't do it to the schools that Rahm Emanuel sends his kids. And in D.C., they don't do it to the kids where Barack Obama sends his kids. And it's not just those individuals. It's that class. You know, in the more affluent areas, as he pointed out, they don't do this stuff. They don't do the grill and drill. They don't do it. Because, well, and there's part of me that goes, you know, it's that paternalistic view of what education really should be about. There are those who believe education is simply a means to getting a job. This is how you're gonna hammer out what you're going to do for a living. And we're gonna give you the skills and the training just to do that job. As were the folks like Emanuel or Obama or, you know, Bill Gates or any of them. We want bigger things. We want big thinkers. We want people who are able to solve problems. We want to encourage creativity and thought and those things where, you know, you working kids, don't get too thoughtful. Don't get too creative. Don't think about how bad you're getting screwed. Don't think about the fact that, you know, and like, you know, the statistic I gave. 299% increase in the top 1% pocket, 22% for the bottom 90% over that 40-year period. So disproportionately, who's been taking more of the economic, who's been eating the pie? Sure, not the guy who's making the damn thing. And yet we're saddled with a lot of this insanity going, well, you know, we don't need to fund education. We could have liquor for education. It's insane. And I just saw this. It's another one of those studies where you go, really? Did we really need to have another study to tell us what we really already know? Well, a guy from Cal State University, education professor, a guy named William Jennings. He says parental involvement programs are associated with higher student academic outcomes. You go, really? Did you figure that one out on your own? And no, he actually looked at 51 studies of school-based programs where they go, you know what, we want to encourage the parents to come in and actually participate in their kids' learning. He says in the interview, parents know that reading with children is good generally, but they may not know how to interact with the children to get the maximum benefit out of reading. And I thought of this, I go, you know, that's kind of snobby. Just kind of elitist, if you will. And he goes into talking about, well, you know, parents need to understand that to benefit their children, it's best to go from reading at, you know, 500 level to a 505 level. Versus jumping to 600. And you go, really? I guess that's because we're not that bright either. And I think back to when my local school decided they were going to go to the Chicago school of teaching fifth graders math. It's in a whole new scheme of teaching math. And for me, I go back to, you know, math is pretty constant. 2 plus 2 is probably going to always be 4, unless you're using Corbett math, which depends on how you want it to go. You can make it look however you want. But for me, it's still going to be 4. And, you know, there's a part of me that says, you know, we know what is best in education. We know what works. There are people like Adam. There are teachers around this country who that's their living. And I got a friend who teaches, you know, in the listening area, and he said, look, you know, every parent wants the best for their kids. And what we're being shoveled right now is that these tests are what's best for them. We need to see where they are. We need to assess. We need constant assessment. And he says, you know, the reality is the constant assessment is the everyday, day-to-day interaction they have with that teacher who, as a professional, is evaluating that kid's achievement every single day. And he says, you know, I wish parents would take more of an interest in the day-to-day. Maybe as much as they take in saying, well, we need to have more assessment. It's just a thought. I know it's a tough one, but it's just a thought. And, you know, I don't like to beat up on parents because, you know, look, things are tough. People are working 40, 50, 60 hours a week. Both parents are in the workforce struggling to make ends meet. As we see wages decline, we see income inequality grow. One of the first things that goes away is free time. That disposable time that you get to spend just sitting with your kids reading and just sitting with them interacting. And we hear an awful lot about, oh, we're the party of family values. And I say, nonsense. Party of family values my behind. But then again, you go, whose family? Mine? Obviously not. When you see budgets like this governor's put out, when you see programs that politicians in D.C. and here in Harrisburg put forth that saddle our local school districts with these insane tests, I think this whole testing regime is a huge ripoff. And you go, look where the billionaire money's going. Look where the big money's going. The big money's going into funding these startups. Ron sent me an email. He said the last few weeks in North Carolina, the new governor put his foot in his mouth on Bill Bennett's radio show by denigrating a liberal arts education by saying the success of higher education should be measured by the number of job-ready graduates, not the number of literate, broadly educated graduates. And Ron, it plays exactly what I've been saying. Is education solely about I'm going to be able to get a job? Look, Mr. Employer, this is what I've done for you. As opposed to, I've gone through all this education to benefit me. And because I've done this, now I'm of some worth to this employer above and beyond what I'm to myself. You know, for me, that critical thinking component of this, and I tell my kids this all the time, their generation especially, in this age of Twitter and this age of Facebook and this age of immediacy and short-term thinking and quick messaging, constant soundbiting, evidently we're the first radio program on Vine to put a six-second video up. 6 seconds. That's it. And by the time that they get to be 15, 16, into their 20s, into their work lives, that'll be down to two or three. They're going to be in a situation where they're going to need to be able to solve problems. They're going to need to be able to sit and see the big picture. They're going to need to be able to think critically and to really analyze things. And I fear that we're going to lose that. Because of this type of testing, because of this type of, and maybe I'm wrong, but that's my gut instinct, that's my gut feeling in this, and one of my big fears. And I guess it goes back to what George Carlin said. You know, we want people who are just smart enough to run the machines, but not smart enough to ask why. And maybe that's, you know, I go back to some of my reading as a kid. I think it was Brave New World I read back in eighth or ninth grade, where they had the alphas, the betas, and the epsilons. You know, the 1%, the top 10%, and then everybody else who were the worker bees, and they were disposable. And they kept them constantly drugged and constantly wanting and, you know, basically bread and circus or American Idol and Cheetos. And, well, drugged, of course. And they were disposable. You know, some of that stuff you look back at, it's amazing. How those sci-fi authors, how those people, you know, back in the 30s and the 40s, looked forward and saw the worst in human nature and said, this is where we're going to go. And look at 1984. I mean, you look at some of those old classics, which is why I've told my daughter, mandatory reading. Go take a quick break. When we come back, Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death, no one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Yeah, big fun. The Pope, is resigning. First guy, 600 years, who hasn't died. And I guess, setting a new president, why not? I mean, that's kind of a daunting task. I'm going to take this job, and I'm going to die. That's the end of it. He said no. And I guess I'm okay with that. I'm sure my Catholic friends are waiting for me to say something obnoxious. Not going to. As a broken Catholic, I'm going to let this one go. Give him credit for stepping out, stepping aside. Glad to see it. Good. Bye. Good luck. Pretty simple. Let's find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. and around the world. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, what do you think? The Pope deciding after, what's it been, 8 years? Enough is enough.
Yeah, 6 to 8 years, something like that. Well, he's 85 years old. He couldn't get up the aisle. You need help to get up the aisle. I think he made a sensible managerial decision.
But, hasn't the history been you trust in the people that you put in there and you hang out, long enough to, go graceful, like everybody else, following the line, tradition, all. I mean, he was supposedly the conservative pope, kind of that.
He was, but, Gregory the 12th resigned in 1415, I think it was.
Yeah, I mean, kind of breaking the tradition, kind of breaking the tradition.
Yeah, so he was conservative until he wasn't.
Yeah, well, okay. Good, bad, your thoughts on him?
God's Rottweiler. he's that was his nickname.
Yeah, I know. It just cracks me up every time I hear it.
I know, it's very funny. I can't help thinking about Camilla Parker Bowles because, of course, that was Diana's nickname for her, the Rottweiler.
I love Rottweilers, though.
I know. They're a nice dog. They are a nice dog. Anyway.
They have a bad name. They really have a bad name.
They do have a bad name.
Because some have bad owners.
The dogs only have bad owners. There's nothing wrong with the dog.
Good point.
Nothing wrong.
Now,
with
cats,
that.
On the other hand, are worse.
No. I was giving you a bone. Now, getting back to the Pope, he will be forever besmirched, I'm afraid, with the legacy of sexual abuse in the church, so much of which came to light during his tenure.
Yeah. And someone had sent me an email asking if I thought, maybe there were some bones in his closet. And I said, I'm not getting into that.
There has never been any suggestion that I've ever read that there was.
Yeah,
the only suggestion was that he might have written a letter giving somebody a pass, but there are also statements from him in which he describes sexual abuse as filth.
Right. Yeah, I said I'm not getting into it. I don't know. And then he threw out the Nazi youth thing, and I said, well, I guess that's true. But that's a whole nother discussion, a whole nother ball of wax.
I'm not going to speculate about anybody when I have no evidence.
Right.
And I'm not going to say that I won't speculate when there's no evidence in a way that implies that there might be evidence, because there isn't any.
Yeah. So I guess, when's this all going to happen? I resign at the end of the month? Okay.
Yeah, 28th is when he steps down, and they say that they'll have a new pope elected by Easter. But, once they shut them in that room, they shut them in the room. They have, like, two votes in the morning, two votes in the afternoon, and then a confabbing the rest of the time. But they've got to get a two-thirds majority. It's kind of like a filibuster.
Yeah, but, the thing is, when you're that age, it really isn't that long of a process, right? I mean, you need your naps.
Yeah, but they can argue about it. I mean, they can,
So we're gonna, I guess we're gonna, why can't we have the Pope, you know, why can't there be a seamless transition? We know when he's going, it's not like he's going to die and we go, this was sudden, we know, 28th. Let's have someone in on the 1st.
Doesn't work like that.
Now we gotta wait, we still gotta sit and watch TV waiting for little puffs of smoke out of the chimney.
Yes, it's very exciting.
Okay, if that's what you're into, little puffs of smoke out of the, yeah, good, good, good. All right, well, no big thing there. So tomorrow, big State of the Union address. What are we expecting?
Well, we're expecting that the president is certainly going to be talking about the economy. And, I mean, that's going to be at the heart of what he has to say. There's no question about that. And he's going to seek to define his second-term agenda built around restoring economic prosperity to the middle class. He's going to talk about how there must be a thriving middle class. And he's going to unveil initiatives in education, clean energy, infrastructure, and manufacturing. And he's going to make various points. He's going to want to make the nation a magnet for jobs and manufacturing and providing Americans the skills they need for those jobs and ensuring that hard work leads to a decent living.
Will he go down the path that our governor here in Pennsylvania has professed? He thinks that, you know, the big cracker plant came here to Pennsylvania because Pennsylvania embraces free markets. Granted, they gave him $1.7 billion, but it was really because they embrace free markets.
I don't think he's going to necessarily do anything like, say anything like that. I don't think he's going to be doing a free market speech. I don't think that's the route that he's going to go.
Okay, I hope not.
I don't think he's going to say anything against free markets because, I don't think he's going to come out and say, I'm a commie, you know.
No, there's enough people in the audience who will say that for him.
Exactly. Ted Nugent's going to be there.
Exactly.
So, you know.
Now will Ted misbehave, or do you think he'll be on his best behavior? Because one of my gun friends said, "Oh, I'll bet you he's gonna do something. He'll be the Joe Wilson or the Samuel Alito to catch some news for the next day." You think he'll catch any news?
Well, I don't know. I've actually wondered about this for the last couple of hours. Is he going to misbehave, or is he going to hold his fire and wait for the media frenzy that will gather around him? Just hold himself in. Is he capable of self-restraint?
That's a good question.
And hold himself in long enough so that he can let loose on the media who will fawn over him.
Yeah, and will he take Rubio's thunder?
Well, I think he will to some extent, yes. I think he will.
Maybe they should have just had Ted Nugent give the address.
There you go.
I think it would have been much more interesting than Rubio coming out. But back to the State of the Union. I mean, I'm waiting. I want to see if, you know, during the inaugural, you know, the president talked about gay rights. He talked about, civil rights. He talked about women's rights. Nothing really about workers' rights so much. Will he, do you think, say the dreaded U word, that union word? Will he talk about collective bargaining? Do you think he'll talk about minimum wage, maybe raising wages somehow?
He might, but I think he'll talk about jobs. I don't think he'll talk about raising wages in that sense.
Yeah, because why would we want that?
No, but I don't think he'll talk about it in that sense, in the sense that we will raise the wage. I think he'll talk about making you know, jobs achievable and help giving everybody a fair shot and a fair shake and those time-tested phrases from the campaign trail. Not that he isn't against raising the wage. I just don't know that that's something that he's going to roll out in the address.
Yeah, I mean, I don't buy the whole it's done on its own. I think you have to have a real plan to push forward and to get people back to work. And I'm not sure that I'm seeing that. I hope tomorrow will really roll that out for me.
And it might. I think he's going to challenge Republicans over the automatic spending cuts.
Yeah, do you think the sequester thing is a real issue? To me, it's another one of these. Both parties seem to be, well, we're both against it. We both think it's going to be disastrous, and we both know it's really going to, if we do this, it's going to hurt. My question is, why are we still talking about doing it? If you're both against it, we don't have to. You made this stuff up. As easily as you made it up, you can unmake it.
Because they're completely incapable of compromising with each other in a way that makes sense, because the Republicans will not accept any new revenue.
Yeah, but I mean, here's the thing. You're both looking at each other. You go, we know there's a bullet in the chamber. The gun is pointed at both our feet. We're going to shoot ourselves right in the foot. We can stop this if we want, but it's just too, we want to see it go bang.
I think there will be, I believe that there's going to be a bill introduced by Democrats before the end of the week. And I want to say that it's in the, I can't remember if it's in the House or the Senate, but there is going to be a bill introduced on the sequester by Thursday.
Well, it'll be interesting to see where this goes. It just boggles.
There's a problem, though, because we've got a week's recess next week.
Vacation. Got to have one of those.
Yeah.
And what happens if it – nah, this isn't something that the day it's over, all hell breaks loose and it's the end of civilization, as they let us believe about the fiscal cliff. And then we find out, well, they probably could have gone 3 or 4 or 6 months longer by doing a couple of little things. I mean, that's not that kind of the end of the world is. I mean, the media, you know, kind of props this stuff up. Oh, it's coming. The deadline that dropped. Because most of us in the real world, when we say there's a deadline, there's actually – a deadline.
Yeah. No, it's not. I don't think it's imminent, but things will start to happen. They will have to start putting in motion furloughs. Now, if you're a federal worker, you have to get a letter saying that there's going to be a furlough, and they have to give you 30 days notice. Well, once you've got that letter in 30 days, you're going to start getting furloughs, and then you're only going to be getting 80% of your pay. That's real.
Right.
That'll happen in a month's time.
And then it will become something people really start screaming about.
Yeah, and then you're going to start seeing two-hour lines extra at the airports because they're going to be that's when people are going to start to make a fuss because they're going to be the way it's written, it impacts everybody. So it impacts air traffic controllers. It impacts the TSA. It impacts everybody.
So as someone who's stationed there in Washington, D.C., and who has, you know, your finger on the pulse there, who does that benefit? Who does it hurt? Or does it hurt both parties?
I think it hurts both parties because I don't think that somebody watching this from Indiana is going to distinguish necessarily between who did it and who didn't do it. They're just going to see that it's not working and that the parks are closing.
Yeah, and at some point you got to go, hey, do your job. I mean, all of us have deadlines. All of us have jobs to do. And it seems like they get away with not doing theirs.
Yes.
And they get a little you know, bee in their bonnet, and all of a sudden we want to shut everything down and cause pain and suffering. Just, I don't know. Big weekend guns. I mean, you got Nugent now in the big speech tomorrow. Big gun week.
Yeah, we've got the Senate Judiciary Hearing Committee, the committee hearing tomorrow on guns, also on the assault weapons ban. That's going to be interesting. Lawrence Tribe from Harvard will be one of the witnesses. He'll be talking about the constitutionality of it, so he's always an interesting person to listen to. So that should be an interesting hearing. We've got that coming up. We've got Ted Nugent. We've got the president will reiterate his position on guns in the State of the Union, so that will bring more attention to them. So what with that, what with the hearing, I think there's going to be a lot of attention on guns this week. And,
yeah,
of course, also Gabby Gifford, the former representative from Tucson and her new super PAC, she has rolled out a new 30-second PSA ad, which is airing in the D.C. markets before and after the State of the Union. It's very powerful.
I can't wait to see that. But I saw Joe Biden today. He was in Philadelphia, and he was saying he's coming to the rural areas. He's going to be going into places like where I live and in the middle of the state to say, hey, you know what? Where the polls are already showing people support common sense gun safety regulations. But you know, he says he's coming, and I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, no, I heard that. Yeah, he says he's coming to the rural areas, and he says the idea that we're coming to your shotguns is a bunch of malarkey.
No, and more malarkey.
Malarkey.
He's hung on that one, huh?
He loves malarkey.
Good. And finally, the Violence Against Women Act. This has been, what, about a year now?
It seems that way.
This to me seems like kind of common sense, you know, just, or am I missing something?
Yeah, what you're missing is that there were some expansions in there, including an expansion that non-Native Americans who abuse their Native American partners on tribal lands will now be subjected to tribal courts, because over 50% of cases on tribal lands are not prosecuted, and Native American women are far more likely than any other women in the country to be battered. 1 in 3 Native American women in their lives will be raped. That's
really
a fact. Yes.
And what's the rationale to move it into the other courts?
Because if the non-Native American guy is not tried in the tribal courts, there aren't any prosecutors, because we're talking about parts of the country where you might be 200 or 300 miles from a state's attorney who's going to prosecute it. It doesn't get prosecuted.
Is that, but I mean, constitutionally, is that possible? I mean, as
well, that's what the Republicans say. They say it's not constitutional, so they're against it.
And that's the only holdup.
That's what they say the holdup is.
Hmm. Yeah, and coupling that with the guns thing, it just popped into my head. You know, one of the women on my whose daughter was on my daughter's basketball team. We were talking about guns, and she had asked about the gun thing. She said, "You know, what does she do when one of her crazy coworkers' husbands, or her husband gets, you know, nuts and starts stockpiling arms and threatens to kill the coworker? What should she do?" And I started thinking about the whole gun safety angle, and it's a good question, because what do you do?
Yeah, I know.
Because, you know, you can have a PFA against the person who's going to abuse you, but what about the coworker? It's just the combination of the two just popped into my head. I don't know why. I'm crazy, I guess. Anyway, Victoria, it's great talking with you.
Good to talk to you. Thank you.
Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky. Scientists at Rice University say that skin cells coordinate their motions as they race to cover and ultimately heal wounds. They say this motion can be compared to the way birds swoop and flock in unison.
Previously, it was thought that only the cells at the edge of a wound were actively moving. Dividing cells were thought to passively fill in the middle of a wound. But the researchers at Rice say they've learned that skin heals more efficiently if highly activated cells in every part of a wound exert force as they pull neighboring cells along.
These scientists use a computer model to analyze the physics of cell physical interactions with their neighbor cells in your skin. Part of their goal was to create an integrated way of thinking about how your skin heals itself. The researchers looked to the skies for inspiration, to the way some species of birds flock and move in unison. Like flocks of birds, they said, cells coordinate their motions in order to heal a wound. They said your skin cells see their neighbors, which they described as sticky, and they said each cell pulls and tugs its neighbors in the process of healing skin.
The researchers said that their computer modeling work has a long way to go, but ultimately, they hope to match their models to current work by experimentalists on the movement of cells related to the spread of breast cancer. For more, come to earthsky.org and search for the words cells flock. EarthSky is a clear voice for science. We're at earthsky.org.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
And the radio is in the hands of such a lot of fools trying to unleash the light the way that you can. Radio is salvation. So you better listen to the voice of reason.
Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there from the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. You know, I go back to that. You know, what do you do? You know, I think about, you hear these stories of, you know, a crazy husband going off the deep end and not even crazy, just angry or abusive or, you know, a lot of that stuff who, you know, they had protections from abuse. Yet they somehow still got the gun, and they still somehow went to the office, and they still somehow shot a couple of people. And, you know, this person said, you know, hey, you know, what do you do? What do I do? What about my rights? What about my rights not to be shot? And, you know, I go back to what my old man always said. You have got the right to do whatever it is you want to do, as long as your right doesn't infringe on my right. I think it was Justice Black who said, you know, your right to swing your arms around ends at the tip of my nose. Same basic idea. And you look at this, and I'm wondering, you know, with tomorrow being the big, State of the Union address, what's going to come out on the guns issue? I look at this thing with Ted Nugent coming. I'm wondering, will there be any nonsense? Will there be any? Because remember, Nugent called the president a criminal and denounced his vile, evil, America-hating administration, which has been wiping its behind with the Constitution, according to Ted. And he took it a step further in saying if Barack Obama becomes president in November, again, I will either be dead or in jail by this time next year. And we can thank the Republican congressman from Texas, Steve Stockman, who announced that he is going to be bringing Ted to the... Just bring it with him. He says, you know, I'm excited to have a patriot like Ted Nugent next to me in the House chamber to hear from President Obama. Excited. This from a guy who... Believe it or not, his own words, that he, when he got called up for the draft, didn't shower, went in his pants for days, literally, not figuratively, literally went in his pants and left it there for days so that he would smell vile and did, you know, some really bizarre stuff. So that he could get out of it. Going to Vietnam, that is. And he's now this great patriot. And, you know, the thing that gets me is it's... We see a lot of that, don't we? Especially from the folks on the right. And part of me thinks, you know, maybe it was, you know... Maybe it was just the time. And, you know, maybe we should cut them some break. Although they never did with Clinton. Even though Clinton actually did have a deferment number. I don't know. It's mind-blowing to me at the minimum. So it'll be interesting to see what the president has to say. We will be here tomorrow with special analysis after the president's State of the Union address. I'm hoping to hear something about workers. I know he's going to talk about jobs, but what about the people that are in those jobs? What about those workers? Again, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like a tide flood beneath the moon, our sway, imperial.